I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
And we're back. PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo here with Sam Monson. Sam, we took a week off, recharged the batteries. You took a little vacation, staycation, and we're back at it for season 9, by the way. We're doing the season 9 PFF NFL podcast. That's where we are right now in our lifespan.
Nine. Most shows don't make it to season 9. Isn't that usually when the wheels fall off? That's the sketchy writing at the back end, and we have to wrap the whole thing up.
We're the other way.
Disappointing finale.
Our sketchy writing happens during the 2016 season when Renner took over, and you guys did. Like, that's when we went down, and now we're working our way back up.
We need one of those
credibility.
We need one of those like swan song episodes where you bring back everybody from the first series. You know, so Ben comes on, Mike comes on,
Tuckman.
Yeah, Tuckman comes back. Tuckman. Get everybody back from the first couple of series, and we just have like a nice. There's some sort of music, and everyone makes an appearance. It'd be great.
Everybody at PFF has at least been on the show once, right? Like pretty much. We did a whole like we had a whole retro look at PFF at one point. So we had Neil, we had Ian, the guy who knows nothing about football and just, the IT director. Here's what I want to know from our listeners, the millions and millions of people out there. How many of you have been with us essentially since 2012, maybe 13, when we started the podcast, we were young. We had Sam and I working with David Tuckman, who was our host, and we went through different iterations of that too, Sam. We had a couple shows. We had like a whole season. We did the three of us on there at the same time, where he would kind of sit in the middle and bounce it back and forth. We did some where you and I would switch off by week, and he'd get Mike Clay on there to do some fantasy stuff. Like, we've had all sorts of different iterations of this podcast. We threw the Big Time Throwcast on the feed at one time.
Yeah.
That was a big hit.
Yeah.
Mac and I, talked quarterbacks, Big Time Throwcast. That could have taken off.
It's almost like the name was a problem. Tuckman was the host back when we didn't have any idea how to host anything.
Now look at us. Look at me hosting.
Now we're fine.
Look at me. Just
now you're just
direct
seamless
in the conversation. This is beautiful.
So hang on. I didn't tell you about my stay vacation thing, right?
Yeah.
Almost all of it was at home. We went away to a cabin in the woods for a few days, right at the start. Do you know how close we are to like legit Amish country here?
No.
Really close. Like really, really close. You head out east for like 40 minutes. You're in deep into Amish country.
Really?
Now, I don't know that much about Amish, right? I just know they dress in the weird old ye olde outfits and they don't use electricity or whatever, right? So you get there and they're all poodling around their buggies and horses and stuff. The other thing they do is rollerblade.
Really?
You've got because apparently that like takes the boxes, right? It's just wheels on feet.
Yeah, it's not, you don't have to plug it in.
There's no engine. There's no electricity. It's just, motor. It's just motorless transport.
They're 40 minutes away?
Pretty much. So
I didn't know that they were that close.
You get out there and there's these guys in like, sort of the underslung beard, the neck beard thing, the hat, the like cravat tie dealy, and rollerblades. And it's just bizarre. So on the way back, we went into this like Amish furniture store thing. So it's funny because myself and my wife are like, they say opposites attract. We agree on basically nothing. Nothing. You have the exact opposite taste on pretty much everything in the world. So I like, solidly well-built, handmade, wooden, rustic type furniture, right? Kind of crap the Amish hammer together when they've got nothing else to do. She likes, like white, shiny stuff that came from IKEA. So we're in this.
Put together yourself.
That's a big problem. But anyway, she just, you know, the nice sort of white, shiny, minimalist type look. Whereas I'm in there, like in this Amish shop, like looking at all these like really solidly built, you know, table, like big rustic solid kitchen tables and all that kind of stuff. But so they've got all this giant warehouse thing of furniture. And then they've got like, you know, including for like kitchens, living rooms, desks, office furniture and stuff. Right. And they've got, they obviously, they know their market. So they're selling to, you know, regular people that use electricity and stuff. So where the TV should go in like the unit, they've got like this cardboard picture of a TV just like plonked in the hole. And then same thing for like the office furniture, right? Where your desk is, there's like a pretend iMac done in cardboard, just put there. It's like insert iMac right here. It was pretty good. I definitely wanted to buy stuff, but I wasn't allowed.
I'm shocked that you would disagree with someone in your life like your wife.
It's not like it's one-way traffic, you know.
I'm just saying. Anyway, for those tuning in to listen to some football, we're going to start our team preview series. AFC East starts right now. Sam and I combined. Sam did about 20% of the work here, but we combined to do team previews for all 32 teams. They're over at pff.com. Went position by position, tried to give you an extensive look at, you know, what to expect in 2020, the depth chart. And of course, since we took our little week off to recharge, a lot of stuff's happened. We've had a Jamal Adams trade. We've had a lot of opt-outs, 80% of which I think have happened in the AFC East. So starting the AFC East gives us a good opportunity to discuss all of the New England Patriots opt-outs and what that means. And we'll just stick with that division and knock out one per show over the next few weeks.
Yeah, let's just start with the opt-outs generally for a second. Were you surprised by how many there have been? When's the deadline? It's coming. They want to move it up, right? Because probably there have been
Wednesday.
So many.
I think it's this Wednesday.
Yeah. So have you been surprised at how many there are?
I am surprised. I don't know if I put too much. I didn't put too much thought into it. I don't think I went down and said, "Hey, I wonder how many guys are going to opt out." But I think when they all, especially when they come in bunches, it starts to be surprising. And it's like, and it's all mostly. I mean, they're all good reasons. I think everybody has a reason for why they're doing it, and it's their choice.
I make 40 so far.
40 opt-outs?
Yeah, total.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's not a ton as like a percentage, but I honestly think we might see a lot more by the deadline.
Yeah, and I mean, it's already more than I expected there to be, I think.
Yeah, because there's a lot of, I mean, it depends on your perspective too, because there's a lot of money on the line potentially. Yeah. It depends on how the NFL has ranked your pre-existing conditions and all this stuff. So there's a lot that goes into it. And I think it obviously, when we talk about the New England Patriots and the fact that in addition to losing most of their defensive players, they've also lost half their defense, I think, to opt out too. So they have a lot of holes now because of all this.
Do you think there's anything to, I mean, so the Patriots have had 8 guys opt out. The next highest team has had 3, and there's a whole bunch with 2. A ton of teams haven't had anybody bounce. Is there anything to that, or is it just weird coincidence?
I think, so a few years, I mentioned this to you off air, right? A few years ago, a lot of the 49ers were like the team that had guys retiring early. Remember, like, Anthony Davis retired, Patrick Willis, Chris Borland. I think if anything, there's, guys talk, right? Like, they're friends, right? So Dante Hightower is probably good friends with Patrick Chung, and they're good friends with the next guy, you know, whoever else, you know, Marcus Cannon or whatever. And they all have their own individual reasons, but I would imagine that they discuss some of the stuff. What are you going to do? What do you think?
Right.
You know, you've got this you're dealing with, you got this you're dealing with, and maybe there's just something to, all right, yeah, you know, this is like, you know, just getting advice or, you know, having a friendly relationship where, you know, that tends to happen. I also wonder with the Patriots, if it's easier, Nate Solder also opted out. That was kind of that was kind of an expected one. A guy who used to have cancer, his son has cancer that he's been battling. But I also wonder for players, they do want to win, and they do, like, probably, I don't know if they want to win as much as fans want them to win. You know, like, this is their job, and they need to. They're. You really get to this point as a professional athlete, Sam. You're trying to provide for your family. Like, you're trying to first, and then it, like, fans care way more about winning. But I do wonder how much guys like the Patriots, like, I got all these Super Bowl rings, like, I got all this stuff, you know, like, I've got these things that you try to achieve, and I'm right. more willing to step back.
I mean, there's definitely, like you said, there's a sort of wide spectrum of guys that have opted out, and some of them make a ton of sense compared with others. Right? I mean, like Nate Solder, as you said, was expected. He's the poster child for a guy that should be opting out, right? He's
for sure.
already made a ton of money, a ton of money. He's dealt with cancer. His son's dealt with cancer. Like, they are as high risk as it's going to get. And there's almost no upside for him. So why wouldn't you opt out if there's an option there to do it? That makes a ton of sense. What's interesting to me is there's also these guys, you know, we've dealt with this a little bit in terms of skirting around the concussion idea, this idea that guys don't want to self-report this stuff because that's where you get put on the shelf and that's where your job disappears if you're not out there, right? You need to be out there to maintain your spot on the roster, otherwise you're gone. There's a bunch of these guys who would have been like roster bubble guys who are instead essentially saying, you know what, I'm not going to risk it this year. I'm not going to, you know, chase what is a possibility for the risk. Like, I think what you're seeing is, you know, as much as there's debate among the general populace as to how severe this COVID stuff is and how much you should be taking it seriously and how much of a risk it is to any one of us individually, the second you have something that changes that dynamic, like, I'm lucky enough that my immediate family is all healthy enough, you know, as far as we know.
Yep.
None of us are clear risk factors in terms of age, in terms of weight, obesity, underlying illnesses. We're good, right? We're relatively low risk. But like, if you had somebody that was immunosuppressed through chemo or whatever, if you had, you were dealing with any of this stuff, it immediately changes everything. Like, as soon as that happens, you're in this camp of, I am not risking this unless you can 100% assure me it's going to be buttoned up tight, and you can't. So I'm out.
Yeah. College football is dealing with this too. I also imagine that there's kind of a stress level of, look, again, varying degrees of how bad is it when you get it, or in the opinions of how bad it is for you personally when you get it. But I think the stress of trying to not get it is a thing as well, right? Like, you got to be in the locker room, you got to be social, you're being put into the situation where you do have to be around people a lot, and it's just like there's like a lot of work to do to not be around people and to not sneeze on people or whatever it might be, right? So I think that's
and it's a constant battle to not sneeze on people.
I'm always trying to not sneeze on people. Get a cover. Anyway, let's go through the AFC East. Name a team, AFC East. Let's kick it off.
Well, let's start alphabetically. Let's start with the Bills.
Buffalo Bills, the first team in our team preview. All right. I think the Bills are good. I think they're going to be good. Here's the deal. They are, as I was going through and I did their, you know, we go position by position. I did their team ranks. I was actually surprised at where they ended up from a ranking standpoint, like across the board. You know, so we go in just position by position and you go through, and most of their positions were kind of on the bottom half of the league. Offensive lines, like right in the middle. Running backs, whatever. Defensive line, was it 20? Like, it's not great, but it's got some depth. Linebackers, I know Bills fans probably believe in them a little bit more than we do, but we have them like middle of the pack because they didn't tackle all that well. But where they're strong, receiver and secondary. Of course, it'll come down to the quarterback. But my point is, they feel like they should have a good roster. But when you go position by position, it's not great, but it's good in the right spots, receiver and secondary.
That second part, I think, is one of the keys that, they are good. If you're going to overachieve, that's a good way of doing it, is being strong in the right areas and weak in the right areas. You know, if you're going to have flaws, have them in the least consequential spaces. And if you're going to have strengths, have them in the most consequential. So that's helpful. But we've also said for the past couple of seasons now that the Bills, I don't want to say they've been overachieving, but they are consistently generating results greater than the sum of their parts, right? So it therefore stands to reason that when you distill it down to the parts, they'll look worse. So I think that all makes sense, that when you actually divide it up position by position, the Bills don't look as good as they are when you build all those pieces together and you actually end up with something significantly better, because the thing that makes Buffalo markedly better than those pieces is the coaching and the scheme and what happens when you put all those pieces in the right situation. So I think the fact that they have that coaching group of, you know, Sean McDermott, Leslie Frazier, Brian Daboll, Heath Farwell. Did you know Heath Farwell was their special teams coordinator? Old Nails. Nails.
No, Farwell. I did not realize that.
Neither did I. But when, you know, the coaching ticket, I think, is a significant part of this team being really good going forward. I love that receiving group. I mean, I've said this before that we've kind of talked about this plenty on the podcast.
It's season 9. It's a new season.
Nobody's listening to season 9
it's
yet.
Just start. We can repeat ourselves now. That's why I did it.
Perfect.
We repeat ourselves. Yeah.
You know, the longer we've been doing this, the more convinced I become that the single most important trait for a receiver is just being able to separate. You know, and it almost sounds too obvious to put like that, but you want guys that get open. You want guys that generate separation. And if that, everybody has flaws. Everybody's got something that they don't do as well as they do other things. And if you're going to have flaw, have it in the contested catches, have it in, you know, run after the catch, whatever you want, blocking. Don't have it in separation. Have your strength in separation, have your flaw something else, because ultimately that's the most important thing. Not just because it helps across the board, right? It buys the quarterback extra room. It also buys you margin for error at the back end. And the thing that I've been sort of thinking of more recently is that I think it fundamentally makes quarterback's life easier by the picture you paint them. So one of the reasons that people talk about the game slowing down for players when they hit the NFL, once they've been there for a while, you know, that first of all, the speed difference between the college game and the NFL game sort of overwhelms them, and then it starts to slow down. And I think one of the reasons that is for quarterbacks in particular is because there's a massive difference between college open and NFL open when it comes to wide receivers. So there was this anecdote, I think, of Peyton Manning and Bruce Arians. Peyton Manning threw the ball away, right? Arians reams him in the meeting room, right? Rolls his back and it's like, why didn't you throw it to somebody? And he's like, who? Nobody's open. He's like, Peyton, this is open in the NFL. Like, this guy needs to get the ball. You can't throw that away. This guy, you need to learn that this is what open looks like in the NFL. This is a guy with like, you know, a half shade of inside leverage on his move.
Yeah,
like it took Manning, you know, a season to figure that out or whatever. Like, it takes these guys a while to work out what it looks like. So if you get guys that separate more, you make that easier because suddenly you don't have to compute, all right, he's not college open. Is he NFL open? Yes, he is. Let's throw it to him. You look up and it's like, all right, that guy's open. You save that beat of mental computation. So when you've got a guy like Josh Allen surrounding him with guys that change that picture fundamentally, has to be really good for his development.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. That is absolutely true. And I'll add to that. When guys get open and they get open quickly, that is what protects the offensive line. That is what allows the quarterback to get rid of the ball quicker and protect the line. And it is the reason why we use the term creep back toward average. It's the reason why we say, look, you don't necessarily need an offensive line that is the top, that is top three, that's going to give you an hour to throw the ball or anything like that. You just need to not be a disaster. You just need to not, you essentially need your linemen to not lose in the time that it takes one of the first two receivers to get open. So if you have a top two receivers that get open quickly, you can deal with a lesser offensive line. I think the Bills have done a really nice job, and Jets fans, when we get there, Jets fans might look at the Bills offensive line building and say, that's all we need, right? They threw a whole bunch of stuff at the wall over the last 2 or 3 years. They've brought in the one guy that's remained there is Deion Dawkins. He's remained there at left tackle. And since, since the new regime came in, you've got Quentin Spain coming in from Tennessee, Mitch Morse from the Chiefs. John Feliciano is out for the season with a torn pec now, so no longer scheduled to start, but they still have Darrell Williams, again, from the Panthers, who they might be a rejuvenation project. Ty Insecki, that's my guy. Ty Insecki, former Washington player. He has been quietly one of the best swing tackles in the NFL for like 6 years. And he might finally have a chance to start. You could kick Cody Ford into guard. I mean, they have like 8 legitimate guys with starting experience that are all potential mid-tier type options. So, I mean, that's a good way of building an offensive line.
Oh, I think if you asked the Jets right now if they would take the Bills offensive line in terms of where their new 5 group is going to get to, like if you said, given the range of outcomes with the people you just acquired on your offensive line, would you accept an outcome of that group being the Bills? I think they'd say, hell yeah. Like, give me that right now. I'll take it. Sure, the potential is much higher, but I will absolutely take that baseline from the group that we've just assembled.
Yeah, so I think they could figure out, they can get a starting 5 that's reasonable. Cody Ford might be the key there, the 2019 second round pick. Need to see him improve, but I mean, they've got a decent, solid group.
Since you brought it up, let me piss some people off with a quick tangent. Am I the only one that thinks terming them the Washington football team for this year is actually marketing genius?
I mean, if you make a case.
Okay, let me tell you why, right? So the pressure has finally reached the point where you've agreed, yeah, we need to dump this racist name. Let's get rid of it. So that happens, right? Now you're stuck. What do you do? You're dumping the name immediately. So you're left with something. There's some kind of issue with this dude squatting on the various names. So you got to either work through that if you want one of those things or come up with a completely new name. The biggest problem is you've got all this merchandise that you've got to like spool up and get everything functioning in like a couple of weeks. That's pretty tough to do. But what you can do is when you make this change, there's going to be a ton of merchandising sales from everyone jumping on board of, you know, you got to get anyone that was a team, anyone that was a fan of that team has to get new gear.
So got to get some WFT gear.
Right. So if generally having like an interim step potentially lets you increase money, right? Because you're going to get the new gear when you sell it, and then you're going to get the interim gear for this year, however much that is, right? Yep. So generally having some kind of interim stage, I think, is a good marketing move. What makes it genius is having a name that's basically the worst possible dumb name you could think of, right? The Washington football team is going to be the single biggest way you could maximize sales, because everybody is going to buy that for a joke, right? If you had just called yourself
1 year of
right, if you had had 1 year where it was just Washington, nobody would have cared. But because you've put Washington football team, it's so ridiculous. You're going to have a ton of people that buy that for the comedic value that would never have thought about buying it before. So you've like maximized the amount of money you could make. You're A, getting 2 waves of merchandise sales, and B, you've maximized the middle one by having a comedy name as opposed to just a generic placeholder.
Oh, I could buy that. I could buy all that. I mean, obviously they couldn't just make a name. They couldn't just, you don't have enough time to get the new name.
Right.
So you have to have some sort of transition.
They could have just put Washington and dumped, true, like a dump the logo mascot thing, right?
So you
and
think it's
I contend that having a ridiculous, like, insert a name, having the Rob Lowe of names in your as your franchise is the way to maximize the revenue for this year.
An organization known for their great decision making made a great decision. Is that what you're saying?
I plead the fifth.
Pled over here as well. I think that's a fair genius call. AFC East podcast, though. I like your tangents. They're good. You're right. Washington football team. I'll buy some of their gear. I tried to get in touch with some of my contacts there. I need some gear sent over here. I need some WFT stuff.
Since you said you love the tangents, I need to fact check this because it sounds so absurd that I can't even believe that it's true. You know this idea of pleading the fifth, right? You take the fifth because it's the right to not incriminate yourself with your answer, right?
Yes.
So you plead the fifth, therefore you don't have to get stuck. So apparently it's like a tactic from law enforcement that if you give somebody immunity from the thing that they were going to incriminate themselves to, you are functionally no longer allowed to plead the fifth because you can't incriminate yourself to a charge you've already been let off, essentially. So what they will do is be like, if they want an answer to this thing, They give you immunity to the thing that you're about to incriminate yourself to, and then you cannot take the fifth. I heard this in a documentary or something, and it sounded so absurd at the time.
So once you took immunity...
Once immunity is offered to you, not even that you took it, once it's offered to you, you can't plead the fifth because you can't incriminate yourself to something that's being essentially dropped that you're immune to prosecution over. Now,
But if you take immunity, then you're fine.
Yeah, but the point is you would then have to because a lot of the times in like mafia cases or whatever, they plead the fifth so they don't have to like incriminate not just themselves, but like the boss.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, I want to stop them pleading the fifth so that the boss gets off. So we just give them immunity. Now they can't take the, like, you know what I mean? So they stop them covering up for other people by giving them immunity. But it's, I've meant to fact check it at the time and haven't gotten around to it, but it seems so absurd for that to be true.
Come on, don't bring your tangent unless it's been fact checked.
It must be that you have to actually accept it, right? It can't just be them offering it to you renders the fifth null and void. It has to be that you accept it and then it's null and void.
I prefer to just talk and then let our listeners fact check us.
Well, as a natural American, it feels like you should have knowledge of this. No, I'm just an interloper into this country. This is your place.
Oh, you're an American now. You've got the card.
I am a permanent resident. I am not yet an American. That's down the line.
Still can't believe we're letting you stay. All right, let's get back to the Buffalo Bills here.
Their
receivers are good.
Already.
The receivers are good. The offensive line's reasonable enough. Mm-hmm. Their running backs, Devin Singletary and Zach Moss, they're not complete clones because you could say Zach Moss is a Kareem Hunt's clone. Like, he's close to a lot of other guys, but both guys very similar in that they're not big play dynamic players. But boy, do they make people miss, and they made people miss quite a bit in college. So that's where Singletary and Moss, they're two of the three best running backs in just missed tackles per touch, essentially, that we've seen coming out of college.
Yeah.
And they both run in the 4.6s. So they're very similar in that regard. They also have TJ Yeldon there. But I think – and then you have Josh Allen. So they have an offense between the three –
Josh Allen a running back?
Ooh, did I do that?
Oof.
I didn't, but I was I could see how you might think that. It's it's like missing the Oxford comma there. Then it just combined them. So if you look at their offense, three tough receivers to cover: John Brown, Stephon Diggs, Cole Beasley, all with three unique skill sets. Throw in Isaiah McKenzie, their jet sweep dude, and all right, there's four unique skill sets. Maybe a fifth guy emerges. Two running backs that are tough to tackle: Dawson Knox, an emerging, somewhat athletic tight end. And then a big athletic tight end in Josh Allen, who also plays quarterback. You didn't catch that one. Who plays quarterback.
Wow.
Tough to tackle. Great scrambler. He's going to have open dudes to throw to. This is a difficult offense to defend.
You didn't even mention your favorite rugby player.
Who did I miss?
Can you even – looking at their depth chart now, can you even pick the rugby player out of the lineup?
Who, Becker? Christian Wade.
There you go. You got there. Christian Wade.
I looked at
he was
some
the guy
sort
that,
of like
it was like Becker his first felt carry.
Like he, Becker felt like some sort of Australian rugby player or something that I did.
It was like I think it was Wade's first carry, right? In the preseason. He rattled off like a 45-yard touchdown.
All right. Stay on point now here.
He's had that like, you know, exemption. They get the sort of the international guys to get X number of practice squad spots, I think. And he's had that exemption the whole time. So he's been learning running back the whole way. It'd be interesting to see if he sticks on the roster this time because the guy's got legit speed and clearly game-breaking talent.
By the way, I'm just looking at the quarterback depth chart. I love this. You have Josh Allen, cannon for an arm, some accuracy issues. Then you have Matt Barkley.
It's ridiculous.
No arm.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's actually played some decent football at times throughout his career. Then you have Davis Webb.
Mm-hmm.
Big arm. No clue where it's going. Then you have Jake Fromm.
Right.
No arm. Accurate. Pretty good decision maker. It's awesome. I love it.
It's like, you know, it's like people that, you know, they don't see color. There's no racial bias there. The Bills have that thing except with arm strength. I don't see arm strength.
I just see
mental processing. I don't care how fast the ball comes out of his arm. I don't care how hard he can
throw.
Take
all those guys.
It's just, I don't see arm strength. I just see processing ability and accuracy.
Here's what I like about the Bills offense as well. I think they're really good. I don't know how much this is worth, but I think they're really good just like on the edges of the roster. So guys like Lee Smith at tight end, the dude who catches like three passes a year, a legitimate run blocking tight end. Tyler Kroft, a pretty good run blocking tight end. So like when you're filling out your roster, you want to have a guy that can run block a tight end. Like you kind of just want to have like the Bills have two of those guys.
How amazing is it in today's NFL, in the NFL of 2020, there is still a roster spot available for a Lee Smith?
Yeah, I mean, I get it, though, because you still want to run the ball at some point. I mean, teams still want to run the ball at some point, no matter what we tell them.
Well, this
so
is
if you're
addition,
going to,
yeah, this you want is somebody in addition that's pretty good at that. To like a legitimate fullback. Like they have a Patrick DeMarco.
Yeah.
It just feels like, if you're going to have, like, what is the point of a blocking tight end in today's NFL above a sixth offensive lineman?
Now, that's a fair question. And we already talked about the depth that they have at offensive line. They apparently like right. Ryan Bates quite a bit. He's a second-year undrafted player. Initially started with the Eagles, was okay last year, especially in the run game. I think their depth is really good. Say what you want about it, whether or not you need a run blocking tight end, like they have one, they have a fullback, they have a fourth and fifth receiver that can do some stuff on the field. I think they've got some depth on offense. So all that said, it comes down to Josh Allen throwing the ball.
Yes.
And that's going to be huge. I mean, I think he could have a year where he doesn't really improve as a quarterback, but he has better stats because of all this around him.
Do you know how many routes Lee Smith ran last season?
42.
64, up from 49 the previous season with Oakland. So
it's like 200 run blocking snaps, right?
Yes, 205. My question would be, like, are you seriously telling me that there is a dramatic gain from the 64 times Lee Smith runs a route that he warrants a roster spot but in addition to a tie in Secchi? Like, you're telling me there's that much of a difference between the 64 times Lee Smith runs a pass pattern versus 64 times Tyen Secchi would have to run off the line that it's worth like carrying him on the roster?
Lee Smith is bringing an extra, he's bringing a safety down in the box, you know, like,
but you can't,
Secchi might bring an extra linebacker on the field.
You're telling me they're covering Lee Smith with a DB?
No. Glorified tackle as it is.
That's what I'm saying. So he probably he's not going to block as well as Tyen Secchi. So you're missing out.
You don't know
at least
that.
Something.
He's a tackle
on the 200 and the 280 snaps he's blocking, and you have to offset that on the 64 times you want him to run some kind of pass pattern.
Sam, stay on point.
I'm on point. I've come to the conclusion that genuine blocking tight ends right now are a waste of a roster spot. They're right up there with the Chad Hennies in terms of coaching. There should be coaches. There's no purpose for that guy being on the roster. Bless him. Bless Lee Smith. I love the guy. He's funny.
Look, I love it. I just love looking at, hey, they got a blocking tight end.
That's
they got
a waste
fullback,
of a roster spot.
Wide receiver 4. We're getting into the weeds here. Let's talk about the defense, and we'll circle back to the Josh Allen discussion.
All right.
Defensively. They don't have a dynamic threat on the defensive line, but they've got some depth. Jerry Hughes has led the team in pressures every year since he got there in 2013. That was fascinating to me when I saw it. In part because Jerry Hughes has been incredibly consistent and because he's been like without a running mate for a couple of years as far as pure name value goes. But the way they're going to stitch this together with Mario Addison coming over from Carolina, AJ Epinesa, second round pick, Quentin Jefferson coming in from Seattle, Trent Murphy's there. I mean, they got all these guys. Vernon Butler comes in from Carolina, and then the guy that they need is Ed Oliver, last year's first round pick, to kind of just take that next step. But I think they're one of the defensive lines that's going to roll 8 deep. Harrison Phillips comes in, plays the run pretty well. They've got like 8 legitimate guys that are going to rotate in and out there. Jerry Hughes being the best pass rusher. It's solid, but you need like Epinesa to really step up, Ed Oliver to step. You need one of those guys to step up and add a more consistent threat rushing the passer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that undersells Jerry Hughes in terms of being a legit, you know, top-end threat. last year wasn't a great grade from him, but the year before he had a PFF pass rushing grade of 90. And as you said, he's been this consistent, dominant edge rusher for them the whole way. I think he is still an elite pass rushing threat for them. The problem is, as you said, they basically haven't had anyone else for his entire time there. You know, even the guys they caught, he caught the tail end of Kyle Williams' career, you know, when he wasn't the force that he was earlier in his career. And they just couldn't partner him with anybody that was a plus pass rusher in particular. The two players I think that really intrigue me are, one, what does Ed Oliver do this year? Does he develop into this pass rushing threat that his athleticism says he should be? He's flashed that ability, but he drew all these comparisons to Aaron Donald coming out because undersized guy, freaky athlete, but there's more to, you know, there's more to Aaron Donald than just being small and a freaky athlete. Like, he was also one of the most developed pass rushers to come out in
hand
years.
Usage. Incredible.
Right. It was absurd. And Ed Oliver didn't have that. And he didn't, you know, not only did he not have that, but he didn't even have the alignment advantages that Aaron Donald had in college in terms of being deployed the right way to be a plus pass rusher. So it was always going to be a work in progress. So where is that progress this year? I think that's one of the big questions for this Buffalo defensive front. And then what AJ Epenesa ends up being is another intriguing thing, right? Because he's this sort of really dominant college edge who was basically prohibitively bad in terms of testing and athleticism and measurables to play like a legitimate edge at the next level. So what does his role end up looking like? Does he get kicked in permanently to an interior position? Does he become the power edge that they were never quite able to get from, help me out, name?
Shaq Lawson.
There you go. From Shaq Lawson. You know, what does Epenesa end up being? Can he be like a plus addition right out of the gate? Those are the two big question marks from this front.
I love Epenesa. I loved watching him. He did remind me of Trey Flowers. Don't forget Trey Flowers, former Patriot and Lion, current Lion, only played four snaps his rookie season, was injured, and it took him, because of the injury, it took him a while. But once he got going, Trey Flowers was an edge by name who did move up and down the defensive line, played a lot of nose tackle snaps, beats up on centers. Epenesa has hands like cinder blocks. Like, he could beat up some offensive linemen with hand usage and all that stuff. So I am interested to see him and Oliver. You know, they're the keys, I think, complementing Hughes as Hughes gets older. Now, the back seven, again, is where I think the Bills win. Everybody loves Tremaine Edmonds because he picks up a lot of tackles. He also missed quite a few tackles last year. Matt Milano was a top five, top six coverage linebacker last year. People don't realize that as much. And those guys are deployed in creative ways. They got to cover backs. They got to play zone. They got to do a lot of things. It's an athletic, like, Milano covers well. Edmonds has a really good athleticism and length. Like, that's a solid, it's a solid group. AJ Klein's in there now, but it's really an Edmonds and Milano show. And then what they've done in the back, the only name that is a star is Tre'Davious White, who is, you know, he's fantastic. He got beat more than, you know, people wanted to admit last year, but White's fantastic. And then since over the last 3 years, Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde, like, that was one of the more underrated moves in the NFL a few years ago, getting Poyer in here, getting Hyde in here. And that entire Sean McDermott tree, fans have asked us this before about, like, which position groups just kind of, like, not that they're easier, but they just always, Panthers safeties were always grading well when McDermott was over there, and he's carried that over to the Bills. He gets the easier. Most out of safeties.
It's easier. There's, you know, I don't think you have to hide from that. It's not necessarily a pejorative.
I'm not saying, I don't know that this role is necessary. There are other positions that are easier, like playing right tackle for Kyle Shanahan. They always grade well. Like, there are certain positions. These guys still have a lot on their plate. They execute it really well, and they run. They're more interchangeable the way they work and all that stuff. So I think it's a nice group.
They have a lot on their plate, but it's easier than trying to be Earl Thomas in a Seattle defense. It just is. Like, it's not a bad thing. Those guys are fantastic at it, but they are in an excellent system to help them look good. And it's a symbiotic thing. They make that defense look good, and the defense makes them look good. So the interesting thing to me is going to be the other cornerback spot. Levi Wallace, to me, feels like a guy that's going to start for 10 years and have a competition for his job every offseason. You know what I mean?
Who's that?
Levi Wallace.
Yeah, yeah.
He's going to spend 10 years as a starter, and every single year they're going to try and replace him. And it's already happened twice. Like, now Josh Norman comes
Kevin
in.
Kevin Johnson and Josh Norman.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. And so Josh Norman comes in, has experience in this coaching system. That was where he had his one elite year in Carolina. He's not that guy anymore. So
I also think for 1 year, $6 million though, well worth a shot just in case.
I don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying that if you're bringing this guy in saying, hey, I saw him be elite in our system a few years ago, he's going to take the job from Levi Wallace and that's a starting corner. I don't think it's going to play out that way. I think you put those two guys in an equal footing. Levi Wallace is a better player right now. Wallace. Yeah. I mean, he's just this classic overachiever, right? That guy's story is insane. He's like still only a few years away from playing like intramural flag football, walks on to Alabama, goes undrafted, wins the starting job from being undrafted. And then, as you say, like sequentially every year is just going to be, they're trying to replace him, but he's good. Like, he's not a bad player. He's, you know, he's probably got a level. Like, he's never going to be as good as Tre'Davious White, but he can, like, in the same way Troy Hill can be a really good number two if Jalen Ramsey is your number one, yeah, Levi Wallace That's can Levi. Be a really good number two if Tre'Davious White is your number one.
As a former flag football champion, wow, intramural champion, I can relate to Levi Wallace. Huh. That's it.
You could not be further away from Levi Wallace's body type if...
Yeah, but we're both intramural flag football champions.
You outweigh him by like 120 pounds.
That's fine. It's like he's on the same team as, you know, Vernon Butler. They can relate to each other. They're teammates.
You're like a whole extra woman in terms of size on top of what Levi Wallace is.
Sam, stay on track here. I'm just trying to say I can relate to the intramural champion. Gotta relate everything to me.
Yeah,
of course. That's my shtick here in season 9 of the PFF NFL podcast. So here's the deal with the defense. 3 straight years of top 10 coverage grades. We always talk about coverage is not stable. Let's do best case and worst case for these teams. Okay. The worst case scenario for the Bills is they've run out of steam working with just a whole bunch of pretty good players, right? With one star on defense, solid across the board, coverage is going to regress, and they're not going to be nearly as good as we thought defensively, even though they've had 3 years of success within this system with a lot of these same players. That would be the worst case scenario for the defense for the Bills, right? And then the best case scenario is, you know, a lot of these guys come together. It's a depth-driven team. And, you know, they're solid again. They're one of the most difficult teams to pass against, which keeps them in every game. But there is a possibility that they just simply regress defensively, because posting 4 straight top 10 coverage grades is really difficult, no matter who you have on the team. It's just a really difficult thing to do. So there is a chance that they regress defensively, Sam.
There
but,
is.
You know, they on paper, they look like a pretty good unit.
Yeah, agreed.
So... Do you want to circle back to Josh Allen?
Oh, yes.
Here's the question I was posed on recent Buffalo radio. Do you think this year they'll be more aggressive? Will they not be as content to win 20-17 than they were previously? And my point was, I don't think they're choosing to win 20-17. That was the nature of their team. They're limited by their quarterback offensively, so they've had to rely on their defense. They did a really nice job last year, and our guy Kev Cole wrote about this last year. They did a really nice job of play calling to give Josh Allen a chance to succeed, to throwing on early downs. The worst thing you can do if you don't trust your quarterback, and I'm not saying the Bills don't, but the worst thing you can do if you don't have a top 3 quarterback or whatever is to just say run, pass. We're going to protect him by running, and then it's 3rd and 8, 3rd and 9. You got to convert those all day. The best thing you can do is actually pass early downs, spread it out, run play action, mix it up, screens, do the whole deal. They've done a really nice job of that in Buffalo. A lot more open throws. Josh Allen's success up to 20 yards was much improved last year, aided in by the fact that John Brown starts, he's open at the intermediate level. He's been a top 15 receiver at the 10-19 yard level. Cole Beasley has gotten open. He's had a higher percentage of open targets of, as any receiver, highest percentage over the last 2 years, Cole Beasley. It's easier from the slot, but he's the guy, number one. So you're making life better for your quarterback. I love that. So all that said, what does Josh Allen do this year? Give me a Josh Allen prediction. You look like you're hard at work over there, too. I can't wait to see what you're whipping up.
Yeah, I'm trying to load up something, but I need to remember my password on the fly to do that. That's the problem, apparently.
Okay, Weddle. That's cool.
Well, no, yeah. Let's not go there.
Did we talk about that now that he's retired?
Sure. We used to get like constant emails that Eric Weddle couldn't remember his password to PFF. And the thing is, we were like resetting his password.
Don't tell him what the password was, but.
I'm like, well, it'll change by now. But we were like resetting it to like his name, you know? Like we weren't making it hard for him to get in, and yet we were still getting a fairly regular email that he forgot.
Great safety. Always in the right position on the football field. Passwords?
Not so much. Well, look, he had all his mental runtime dedicated to like the defense. He didn't have time to remember like his name.
He's a big save my password auto login guy.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? So if it didn't remember it, like the browser hasn't remembered it. I don't know what the hell it was.
So, do you want to get what's your prediction for Josh Allen this year? What do we see from him statistically, grading wise? Does he take a next step? Are Bills fans disappointed and they're looking for a new guy at the end of the year? Like, what do you think happens?
Well, so here's the thing, right? There's what all happens to him. Yeah, there's two things. There's what happens to him, and there's where the perception is. So I do think he takes a step forward. I don't know that it's going to be a big step forward, and that's the problem, right? So I think he will get a little bit better. I think he's gotten a little bit better last year. The big thing to me is whether he sorts out this deep ball thing, because he's such a weird breakdown in terms of what he does. So one, you can disregard the freaky athleticism and rushing skill that he brings, right?
Yep.
Now you can
raises his floor.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you can also dispute how valuable that is, right? So you add up his scrambling yardage and just add it into the offense, right? It doesn't quite work like that because they're not equal plays. So his rushing attempts in total had a negative EPA. So effectively, even like if you said all of his rush attempts put together, they got further away from scoring than they did if he hadn't done it at all, ever. If he just passed the ball instead of taking off and running, they'd have been better off, right? That's basically what that is telling you. Now, it doesn't quite work like that, right? It's more complicated. There's more facets in that. But this idea that, you know, he adds 500 rushing yards or whatever, therefore he's X percent high, like it's not necessarily so. So the rushing, it is a factor, and he can make spectacular plays here and there, but it would be, I think, a mistake to fall into the trap of the idea of, well, he makes these spectacular plays, therefore all of his rushing is a net win, and it's positive, right? Because a lot of that is plays that he should be making through the air with his arm and doesn't. Secondly, he has an absurdly high rate, he has an absurdly high number of ridiculously high degree of accuracy and high degree of difficulty intermediate passes, right?
Good accuracy.
There's a ton of these Bills accounts out there, you know, throwing these highlights of Josh Allen just making sick play here and there. Nobody's ever doubted that those are in his game, right? The guy has, that's why he was drafted where he was, right? He's got the ability to make these insane plays, and he certainly made more of them last year than he did as a rookie. The problem is the bad, right? And for him, the bad last year was very specific. It was anything deep was a disaster. And he has the worst touch of a deep pass I've seen in a long time from a quarterback, maybe ever. That is not that hard. It really isn't. Like, of all the things to do as a quarterback, just putting a bit of air under the ball when you're throwing deep should not be the hardest thing in the world to achieve. You know, there are quarterbacks without the same world of arm talent that Josh Allen has that understand that if they're going to complete a deep pass, the best thing they can do is put as much air under it as possible and let their receiver do the work. For some reason, he hasn't worked that out yet. Or if it has worked it out, he keeps defaulting back to trying to fire it in there like a laser. That has to change, because if it doesn't, the deep pass is the most valuable pass in the NFL. if you can't do that, if you're the worst deep passer in the NFL, you're only ever going to be so good. It just doesn't matter how good you are at everything else. That will be the cap on how good you can be. So I think ultimately, Allen takes a small step forward. I don't know if he can take this seismic leap that we saw from a Lamar Jackson last season. I don't think that's in him, at least certainly not in one go. So I think he gets a little bit better. The little bit better probably makes Bills fans still think he's capable of doing it all. And the other important thing is that the Bills might be significantly better in terms of, you know, winning the division and maybe contending. So again, the things will be in his favor in terms of perception.
A negative EPA thing's real, huh?
Yeah. You thought I was just making it up.
Oh, yeah. I thought you screwed something up for sure.
I know. I can read things.
No, I'm proud of you. So, yeah, I mean, I think that – I think that
live in the show.
Just making sure. I think Josh Allen, with the deep passing stuff, again, I think it goes back to – he missed some wide-open John Brown passes last year, but I think he'll have more open throws. I think that'll positively regress. He'll hit a few more of those. I think Allen has it in him to have one of those years where he's got the 26, 28 passing touchdowns, decent number, another 7 or 8 on the ground. And at the end of the year, you're like, man, this guy's got a ton of touchdowns. Everything in between might not be that much better, but the touchdowns are there in part by the supporting cast, in part because he's got big playability. He makes a bunch of big time throws, still misses a high percentage, still, you know, probably, you know, he's got 15 fumbles over the last 2 years. He's only lost 2. It's another reason why Bills fans, I think, just feel good about, well, Josh Allen takes care of the ball. He doesn't have a ton of interceptions, hasn't lost a ton of fumbles. He's had fumble luck. He's had interception luck. Both of those really, really in his favor. So honestly, it could go, I think it goes either way extreme. I don't know if we see any middle ground this year. I think the Bills either fall apart with high expectations and Josh Allen, the interceptions go the wrong way. The fumbles go the wrong way. He doesn't improve. He misses so many throws, even with more open receivers, and the defense regresses. Or it goes the other way, and Josh Allen has these really nice stats. He improves a little bit. It's still like an uncomfortable. He still misses a few too many throws, but it doesn't matter because you got more open receivers, and it's just better. You've got better yards after the catch, guys. He's got his rushing ability. The defense stays good, and the Bills are right there in the hunt. I'm leaning that way. I think they're in the hunt. I would actually pick them to win the AFC East, especially given everything that's happened with New England. But yeah, there is a possibility that bad stuff happens with Allen and the like, given the higher expectations. It could happen.
So what I think is going to end up happening is that I think the Bills will end up. So they won 10 games last year, right?
Yeah. Think so.
I think we could see them win 9 or 10 games again this year and it feel like a massive disappointment because we thought they were trending in the right direction. But actually what's just happened is that they've sort of hit the wrong end of variance, right? So the fumble swing back. The other thing that's a big, so it this kind of cuts both ways, right? One, we think this division is theirs to win almost because the Patriots have sort of, they don't have Tom Brady anymore. Half their team has just opted out. You know, the Patriots are not what they used to be. Suddenly this division is open for the first time in 20 years. But Buffalo's strength of schedule is significantly harder this year than it was a year ago. So they won 10 games with a really easy strength of schedule, which is one of the reasons that the Patriots still looked dominant. You know, they had it. This Patriots schedule last year was a cakewalk. And the Bills had a lot of that as well. So we're expecting them to be so much better because the Patriots aren't in the picture as much this year, but they're about to run into a significantly harder schedule this year than they did a year ago. So again, it's going to feel like a disappointment, right? You're going to lose a couple of those games. We would have sort of said you're going to win. I think ultimately the Bills almost end up just spinning their wheels and ending up in the same spot, which to them, I think will feel like a disappointment because we expected more.
I think that's a fair take too. They have to play the NFC West, which has four legitimate playoff contenders, if you include Arizona.
Right, which I think
Seattle
have to at this point.
Seattle, the Rams, the 49ers, obviously, and the Cardinals. They have to play the AFC West and the NFC West. So the AFC West has the Chiefs. The Raiders should be improved. The Chargers are going to be a tough team to play. And the Broncos are going to be a tough team. I mean, they're all going to be tough teams. You got the Steelers. You have the Titans. And of course the AFC East. I'm just saying it'll be a challenge this year, I think, for Buffalo. I would still probably pick them in the East.
Right. I mean, even just naming those additional teams, right? Oh, by the way, you also get stuck with the Titans and the Steelers. Right. Like, man, this is a tough schedule.
All right. Let's, man.
You were talking about trying to squeeze two divisions into one of these podcasts. How long did it take us to get through one?
Your fault. It's always your fault. All right, let's get into the Miami Dolphins. They're next in the AFC East.
No opt-outs, so that saves us something.
No opt-outs to discuss for the Dolphins. Give me your high-level view. Or do you want me to? I'll give you my high-level view. That's how I started with the Bills.
Sure.
High-level view of the Dolphins roster. We'll get to the quarterback in a second. I love what they did this offseason with the secondary. I love where they moved as far as getting players into the secondary that fit what they want to do. Ultimately, I still think there are questions back there, but man, they have one of the secondaries I could see move up that moves up quickly. Here's where the concern is when you're going through the position rankings. Offensive line, 32. Yeah. Running backs, 32. I don't care about running backs that much, but you know, defensive line, 30. Linebackers, 29. Those are their rankings. Just as far as position groups go. So receivers, 26, and we were debating having them even lower. It depends on how much you truly believe in Devontae Parker and Albert Wilson bouncing back. The roster still has a lot of work to do. But I like the progress they've made in the secondary. I like the fact that they got Tua in the mix. And Ryan Fitzpatrick, if he ends up playing, is coming off the best two-year stretch of his career. For whatever that's worth, that could mean that he's just ready to, you know, wheels fall off because that's what Fitz does every time he starts playing well. But I think that's where the Dolphins are as a roster, moving in the right direction. But man, they still have some massive holes.
They do. The offensive line, I think, is the biggest one. I mean, last season we saw four of the worst offensive lines we've ever seen in PFF's grading, and Miami's was the worst. Yeah. And it didn't get a whole lot better. Like, I mean, they made some changes to it, but like they still have some pretty horrendous players scheduled to start for them.
They have Austin Jackson, first round tackle, who again we had more as like a late second, third round player, and they drafted in the first round. I see him struggling early on.
That's the thing.
He's got skills, but like right. It's going to be a transition for him.
Even some of the sort of fixes, you know, in air quotes, are not players that you expect to fix that right away. Like if Austin Jackson coming in and even playing average for an NFL tackle, I think would be in the top 10% of his expected outcomes. Like the chances of that happening, I would say, are extremely remote. So that offensive line is going to be a problem again, a major problem. And at which point, like you have to ask yourself, do you even put two out behind that? Or do you just say, hey, Ryan, thanks for what you've done the last couple of years. Your reward is to take a beating for this year because we don't want to risk.
Again.
Yeah, we don't want to risk the young quarterback behind this disaster. The receiving core, I think, could be okay. Like what's amazing about Fitzpatrick is that he's played his best football behind the worst protection he's ever had for 2 years. Like it's not just that he's played the best he's played for 2 years; it's that he's played it despite the worst pass blocking he's been dealing with.
Well, it made more sense with Tampa Bay in 2018 because he was, you know, YOLO ball Fitzpatrick working with a rookie Godwin and Mike Evans
when he was good then.
They had Adam Humphries that year, but the two tight ends were still there. They were pretty good. Like he had dudes to throw to in Tampa Bay that particular year. He had the YOLO year with the Jets with Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker, I think, in 2015. But last year, YOLO Fitzpatrick, you know, creates Devontae Parker into like a contested catch monster and giving him opportunities and everything. They have Albert Wilson back, who's been a yak machine for them. So I don't hate their receiving core as far as like they've got some decent pieces. But again, you got to compare it to like the rest of the league.
Yeah.
It's Devontae Parker and Allen Hurns and Albert Wilson and Preston Williams did a nice job last year. He just dropped so many passes. Like they've got some guys that can do some things.
Yeah, I mean,
got some guys who could do some things.
The offense, I think, it's heading in the right direction. Like, there's a lot of pieces in that offense that I think could be in a very functional offense. It's just, this feels like one of those offenses where the entire thing is going to be capped by the fact that they might have, again, the worst offensive line in the NFL. And, like, a line that bad is only going to let you be so good. The more interesting thing with the Dolphins, I think, is the defense, because that's really heading in the right direction. Obviously, they bring in Brian Flores as the head coach from that New England system. He's creating New England South there. And in a way that most of the sort of New England replicas have been obvious replicas in a sense of flawed and not really as good as the original. This one might not be as good as the original, but I could see a way that this defense suddenly starts to become really quite good. You know, they're loading up in the right places. They've already had Xavier Howard, obviously, on big money. I think Xavier Howard is a little overrated, but again, if he's one of your two top starting corners, that's something you can definitely work with. Byron Jones was the big offseason addition. Noah Igbinoghene comes in to add some slot man coverage ability as well. That's Love a trio him, that could immediately become like one of the best cornerback trios in football.
So do you have any concerns with, because I keep touting Xavier Howard and Byron Jones as a nice combo. Do you have any concerns, though, with how much Miami wants to play man coverage with those two guys? I mean, Xavier Howard, I have concerns because we've always said 1 week he looks like Richard Sherman, 1 week he looks like a bad Big 12 corner. Yeah. That has been the story of his career since the Big 12. We were watching film together at the Combine with him. We were like, watch this play. Oh, watch this play. Right, back and forth. And then even in the NFL, week to week, I mean, he has games where his ball skills are incredible, but like he feels like the guy that's better, like sitting in off coverage, staying on top of routes, not necessarily mirroring all the way, especially against better route runners. And Byron Jones has an element of that too. He could press, he's got good movement skills and everything, but I don't know if you want him straight one-on-one 50, 60 times a game, well, however, 35, 40 times a game.
Right.
You want to mix it up a little bit more. I love it on paper, though, and Igbinoghene might be that guy. Like, he's the one dude. He's going to get beat because that's what happens in the slot, but, man, he has the ability to stick with, say, like the Edelmans of the world in man coverage, and you don't want him playing too much zone. So that's, like, the right pick and the right fit there. I just wonder how much you want these corners playing man coverage.
There is certainly an element of playing with fire in there. On the other hand, though, I think when you start to work out how much man coverage they're actually playing or how many times you're essentially exposing them to getting burned like that, the numbers start to get pretty small, even just when you start to parse it out, right? So, you know, an offense is going to face, what, 60, 70 snaps a game overall, of which 35 are going to be passes. Of those 35, you're playing man coverage 55% of the time. So that's 17. So 17 of them you're in man coverage, of which how many, you know what I mean? How many of those seven? So basically minimum or maximum 17 times you got to hold up generally, right? Most of those are going to be routes where you're not exposed to being burned anyway. So that gets cut down. You know, you basically just need to survive the couple of plays in a game where you're actually at risk of getting toasted deep. Now, both those guys are capable of not surviving that play. But I think what these man coverage teams do, and particularly the non-New England ones, right, the actual replica versions, I think at this point they basically roll the dice that we can hold up, right? Let's say it's five plays. There's five plays a game that we're basically rolling the dice saying that our guy is going to win. And if he doesn't, it's a big play. And that could cost us the game. But if he does, we've made life harder for you on the other 35 plays because we played man coverage and it's broadly speaking a tougher.
And the windows are tighter.
Right. It's broadly speaking tougher on your offense. So I think particularly a team like Miami, they're basically saying, look, we're going to roll the dice that these guys are not going to get exposed on those plays. Xavier Howard in particular has the potential to go the other way, right? He may get burned, but he's also going to catch a ball or two that maybe he shouldn't, or that maybe other cornerbacks would.
It's just, you just don't get as many interceptions in pure man coverage. And that's where,
sure,
if you want him to be like Xavier Howard's best bet is to be like a Marcus Peters type, right? Like you get burned every now and again, but you're going to get 5, 6, 7 interceptions in a given season. And we'll take that because you're turning the ball over. It's just harder to do in the system. I don't hate your breakdown there. I'll say the other thing that they do, Patriots system, Belichick system, they take their pass rushers They press tight ends. They bump them off their routes. They lean safeties. They do all these different things to kind of like dictate the matchups and say, so all that you were like, you were parsing it out. They're even going to say, okay, here's this top receiver. We're going to put a safety over the top and play him, man. We're going to take him out as well. So that's one fewer snap. So, you know, there's something to that. And Flores, he did some good things in New England. You know, like when he did some good things in New England.
Also, Matt Patricia, by the way,
I think he's probably shown himself better than Matt Patricia to this point.
Also, by the way, the quarterback has to find it even when you get beat, right? Think of the number of plays where you see a guy get killed in man coverage off the ball and it never goes that way, right? The quarterback just doesn't see it. It's not his first read, you know, whatever. The ball's gone somewhere else. You know, you've got five plays that you may be exposed to. You may lose one of them. And if the quarterback doesn't see it, it didn't happen. You know, it didn't cost you anything. So I think generally, it's a risk, but I think a scheme like this has embraced that risk and decided that it's a net win.
Let me tell you one other thing I love about the secondary. There are two projected starting safeties, for whatever it's worth. Eric Rowe, Bobby McCain are two former corners. I just love this as a concept. Give me the corners that, you know, move to safety. I thought Eric Rowe, when he came out, he did play safety at Utah for a little bit, then moved to corner. He reminded me a little bit of Devin McCourty as a player who was like just, you know, solid and safe and didn't miss a ton of tackles in college. Hasn't been that guy really in the NFL, but he's had to play a lot of corner. And Devin McCourty had a good year at corner and a bad year at corner and then moved to safety and became a pretty good player. So I like the concept of Rowe playing more safety. He did a little bit last year. McCain, former slot guy playing safety, that adds so much versatility to the defense. And then in the third round, they drafted Brandon Jones, the big safety who just, you know, can cover tight ends pretty well. He's got that one skill set. They have a lot of those Patriots-like players who just do one thing really well. And I really am looking forward to seeing how that, you know, gets deployed and how that works. They add Kyle Van Noy in there, who's been the hybrid player for New England. Christian Wilkins, he's their first round pick that they need better pass rush from, you know, from last year. He was kind of like Ed Oliver for them. Shaq Lawson goes from Buffalo to Miami to be their power end. So they have some interesting pieces that I think could improve their D.
I think you just made a great point that I hadn't even considered before about this Miami team, but they have a ton of players that are very, very specific in terms of what they do well. And the flip side of that, the implication being there's stuff they don't do well, right?
Yeah.
But what makes that New England system so unique is that nobody in the NFL is better than Belichick at putting players in a position to enhance what they do well and to hide what they don't do well, or not ask them to do things that they don't do well. And I think that's one of the major things that separates his defense from all the disciple versions, all the replicas that go off somewhere else. This will be an interesting test to see if Flores has that trait. If he can take these guys that are, you know, flawed diamonds, that are players that are very, very good at specific things and not very good at other things, and make use of that the same way that Belichick has been able to for years. If he can, suddenly you have this Patriots level weapon in terms of an advantage when it comes to, you know, player acquisition, a defense that's better than it looks like it should be, and all those kinds of things.
They're another team, if you just look at, you know, PFF concepts, the teams that have a much better secondary than they had than they do defensive line. So, for instance, we have the Ravens with the number one secondary, 17th in defensive line. We have the Patriots annually. This is their rankings. Third in the secondary, 25th on the defensive line. That's actually like where they've been ranking in their last few Super Bowl champion teams as far as coverage versus pass rush. You have the Seahawks, who are like the epitome of we're way better in the back ends than we are up front. The Dolphins are one of those teams. The Bills are actually one of those teams too, after we just talked to them. The Dolphins are one of those teams that's done a better job building in the back end than they have in the front as far as pass rush ability goes. Again, they've got some role players up front, but like, who's your top pass rusher? Is it Van Noy? Like, he just, by the way, Van Noy played linebacker more his first couple years in New England. He played more pure pass rusher last year. He did a much better job. He did a really nice job rushing the quarterback. But like, he's your best pass rusher. Shaq Lawson, not great. Christian Wilkins, not great. They have a whole bunch of run first type of players, which is another New England trait. They bring in Landon Roberts, run stopping linebacker. Raekwon McMillan, run stopping linebacker. Don't trust those guys in coverage, But to your point, if you just protect them enough throughout the game, you don't have to expose them.
Yeah, and it also brings – it makes players like Curtis Weaver fascinating, right?
Ooh, yeah.
Curtis Weaver goes to most teams, you're like – you know, if they just try and make him into a conventional, like he's not a conventional body type, conventional style of player, right? He probably needs a specific thing working for him. So you go to the Dolphins or the Patriots, it's like, all right, now that becomes interesting because Weaver was ridiculously productive as a pass rusher. But, you know, a guy's got himself a bit of a gut, doesn't look, you know, the most spectacular athlete in the world. So there's a lot of
Lamar
teams,
Houston,
right, teams shy away from that. The guy goes in the fifth round, but in the right system, like those are the kinds of players, if you're prepared to focus on what he does well and not ask him to do the things he doesn't, you find diamonds doing that.
So look, I think there's so many good stories. I can't wait. I hope the NFL happens. I can't wait to watch this season because the storylines are just fantastic. I really want to see how this Dolphins defense comes together. Year two, Brian Flores, and all these new pieces there. So offensively.
Yeah, circle back to the enough? No. Well,
what do you want to circle back to?
The offensive line is going to be their problem on offense. The thing I wanted to circle back to is when do we see Tua? Because the guy's clear now, but I don't want him anywhere near that offensive line. But you don't sit a top 10 pick for any extended period of time in today's NFL.
I don't know if the Dolphins believe their offensive line is that bad because they drafted Austin Jackson in the first. Sure, he's a rookie, but they drafted him in the first. They brought in Ted Karras from New England. He's only started for 1 year in his career. He was solid last year.
Yeah.
It's New England. It's Brady, quick passing, whatever. But he was solid last year. They paid Jesse Davis to come back and play football. He was their best lineman last year. He hasn't graded above 60, yeah, the right tackle. But I think they think they're okay. So I don't know that Miami looks at their offensive line and says, well, we've got the worst offensive line in the league. How can we do this? We do. I don't think that they do. Based off of right tackle investment, first round investment, Ted Karras coming in. And yeah, I think they know that it's a weakness, but I don't know that they're like, man, this is impossible for Tua. So I think it's one of those, like, you give Fitz a couple weeks and then it's Tua. And I think that's mostly because of the practice time. I think that's what we see.
Yeah. I mean, I believe it. I mean, I believe it for no other reason than this plan of, like, everyone comes in with the intention, not everyone, but a lot of people come in with the intention of sitting the first round rookie, and it always goes to hell by like week three.
What's
amazing to me is that the one time in recent memory where that hasn't been true, it's been with Patrick Mahomes, who may be the greatest quarterback the game has ever seen, right? Like the one guy that they actually managed to keep on the bench for a year was maybe the greatest quarterback, like was an MVP right out of the box.
And we were calling for him that year. Like Alex Smith is doing really well, but still bring in Mahomes.
And this... like that might have, I honestly think that their plan, this might have been the one instance where their plan, I think, was to actually put him in and it went the other way. Like, usually the circumstance dictates that the plan to sit the guy has to be thrown out and we have to bring him in, right? The Blake Bortles, Chad Henne thing. In an ideal world, we wanted to sit Blake Bortles all season long, but Chad Henne is Chad Henne.
Chad Henne happened.
And there's only so many weeks you can take that before you just snap and you have to throw out somebody else. Anybody else, it doesn't matter. Just Chad Henne cannot throw the football again for this team. Whereas with Mahomes, it was like, all right, we've got Alex Smith. We know that's a good, solid starting point. We'll give Mahomes, you know, six weeks on the bench, and then we'll bring him in and he'll be a superstar. Only 6 weeks in, like, Alex Smith is playing out of his freaking mind, leading the NFL in passer rating, and is just playing so well that you can't sit him down, even though you know, or they thought they had what they had, which is an MVP in waiting.
Here's I'm going to use the same take I had in 2018. Jameis Winston was suspended. Ryan Fitzpatrick got to start the first few games.
Yeah.
Those first few games could be the Dolphins look like Super Bowl contenders. Or the Dolphins are 0-3, 0-4, like it's Tua time. That's the Fitz magic right there. Because if you do give him a few games to start, he could go off like he did in 20. That's what he did in 2018. You're like, this is the best quarterback in the NFL right now. He's going head to head with Drew Brees. He's completing 80% of his passes and chucking them down the field. Like that could happen, or it could go the other way. Fitz played really well last year. Again, given the offensive line circumstances, the lack of weapons, played football pretty well. But the range of outcomes with Fitz is all over the place.
Miami agrees with him, don't you think? Like the city, the vibe. It's a good Fitz vibe. Miami Magic. Good,
yeah.
The beard.
Absolutely.
I think he suits it.
I think he's done a great job there. He's done a great job. So I say two is like week three, week four. You give him some time. The lack of preseason reps, man. It really, if we didn't have preseason last year, remember when Dan Orlovsky like apologized to Daniel Jones? Sorry, man. I didn't think you were good, but I just saw these 22 preseason throws. You're awesome. Like he apologized for his take on Daniel Jones leading into the season. Nobody can apologize for not believing in Justin Herbert, for instance. We won't be able to see it.
Yeah, but it does just mean that like three passes into their NFL career, it's going to happen.
I know. Well,
sorry.
My point is it's a lot easier for Daniel Jones to look awesome in the preseason than it was in the NFL. So we don't have the preseason overreaction. But I think the lack of preseason reps is a challenge.
I think it's definitely going to lead to some coaches being conservative with personnel decisions.
So let's go, not even best case, worst case, but like, what do you think Dolphins fans should be looking for this season? What constitutes a good, we're moving in the right direction season? Because I think it's fair to say we're still in the middle of the rebuild here.
Yeah, I agree. And I think they're battling the same things that we just talked about with Buffalo. This division schedule gets harder this year than it was a year ago, right? So they're battling with the same deal. They have a tougher schedule. They play the same teams we just talked about. They're going to have a really tough battle in a lot of those games. So I think you have to start looking at this from a performance point of view as opposed to a wins and losses point of view. Look at the defense. Is it taking the steps that we just talked about? Are they putting these guys in the position to succeed? Does it look like Brian Flores has that Bill Belichick ability to play to his player strengths and to minimize their weaknesses? That's huge. The offense, is that offensive line a complete shit show, or does it have the ability to actually protect the quarterback for more than 2 seconds? If it is, we're in business.
And I'd say Tua, when he gets out there, does he look like, does he have star power immediately?
Right.
Is it a challenge? Does the arm strength look like an issue? Trent Dilfer swears by his arm, but I also swear that I haven't seen him throw with incredible zip other than a handful of times. I don't know if that's by design or not.
Sure.
Sometimes it just doesn't look right from an arm strength standpoint immediately at the NFL level. I'll be interested to see that. I think he'll be fine, but he might look like a star right away, or it just might take some time.
Right. And he's an interesting one because, you know, the quarterback position now has become this instant gratification. You know, when you see it. And Tua was that guy in college, right? Like he came in literally first exposure, essentially replacing Jalen Hurts in a national title game. Everything changed, just looked different immediately.
Yep.
So that's been him at the college level. Can he do it again at the NFL level? And then the other thing is, was that Devontae Parker year a blip, or is that him?
Yeah, that'll be huge, I think, for the Dolphins. I think they'll be a tough team to play. I think they'll be solid, but yeah, I think, to your point, my cop out, because I'm trying to skew positive for all 32 teams here. My cop out for a lot of these teams is going to be, oh, they're way better, but they're going to win like six games. Just, you know, you won't see it.
Well,
I
think this is the division where that is going to be the case for all of them, is that look, this division had one of the easiest schedules in the NFL last year, right? As a division. And some teams were even easier when you add it in, and they're out of division, out of conference games or whatever. This year across the board, it's getting harder. So every single one of these teams has a harder gig in 2020 than they had in 2019, just because their schedule is getting tougher. So however much better you think you are than you were a season ago, you have to take a bit off, because it's going to be a tougher road to I don't even know what the phrase is. Tougher road to, I don't know. Someone
to use garden tools on.
Yes.
I think that's the end of the phrase. All right. Only two more teams to get through, Sam. What is going, if you missed last week's podcast, don't worry. We rolled all three into one. That's what we're doing here.
Okay.
It's three podcasts in one. New England Patriots. The New England.
Damn it.
I'm not gonna call them New England opt-outs.
It's a tougher It's tougher to hoe is the right phrase, but it's not road. It's row. The bit that I thought I had wrong, I had right. And the bit that I thought I had right, I had wrong.
That's two times in a row.
Tougher row to hoe.
Row. Two times in a row.
That's what I was trying to say.
Misspelled segue first. New England Patriots already had a ton of turnover. Now, as of recording time, the opt-outs include
safety,
Patrick Chung, linebacker, Dante Hightower, running back, Brandon Bolden, offensive tackle, starting right tackle, that is, Marcus Cannon, starting fullback, Danny Vitale, Najee Turan, offensive lineman with zero offensive snaps last year, Marquise Lee, wide receiver, and then tight end, Matt Lacoste. So, New England, by far, leading the league in opt-outs. They also just have plenty of turnover on the defensive side of the ball. We have seen, obviously, Tom Brady is gone. But we mentioned Kyle Van Noy going to Miami. Jamie Collins goes to Detroit. Danny Shelton's gone. Ted Karras is in Miami. Daron Harmon is in Detroit. They all went to Miami or Detroit, basically. And Brady went to Tampa Bay. So there's a lot of turnover at key positions. So we're looking at a completely different world in New England.
It really is.
How different? Let me just ask you this. If Jarrett Stidham's the quarterback versus Cam Newton, how different is your projection for New England?
Not that different.
For me, it's massive. I think
with Jarrett Stidham as quarterback, they are a bad team. I think with Cam Newton, a quarterback, as is, they are an average team.
That's significant, though.
I mean, it's significant, but it's not like... my problem with the Cam Newton thing, right, is everyone labels him as an MVP. Like, 2015 Cam Newton was an MVP. 2020 Cam Newton is not. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's an MVP
in
the same
year. Was he close to MVP?
Right. But it's not like it shouldn't work the way presidents work, right? You're not an MVP forever. You're an MVP the year you were an MVP. You're not forever that guy. That's not the way it functions.
It's just a descriptor.
But it's not. It's not the way people are using it.
It's not an expectation of talent level.
It honestly is. The way people use it, it's like, this guy is an MVP. That is what you're getting. It's not.
We may have talked more about Cam Newton than any other quarterback on this podcast. And it's because I just put up my quarterback tiers, Sam. He's tier three. He's a tier three quarterback.
How many tiers have you got?
Four.
Okay.
But tier three is like it's your middle class quarterback. It's like quarterback 9 through 2021. Right. I keep using this broad range. I think Cam Newton's been there his entire career. I think he's always been a tier three quarterback. I think he's always been a guy where if in a given year, and those guys, they're volatile on their own merit because they're aggressive, like Cam and Jameis and the Carson Palmer. They're aggressive, and sometimes things go really well, and all the good stuff happens in 1 year, and you have an MVP year. And other times, you know, he's got like three seasons, I think, grading in the 20s in PFF grading. He's only graded in the top 10 twice. So I think he's a tier three quarterback, right? Like in any given year, he could be really good. He could be really bad. He could land in the middle.
20s in rank rather than number. Than grade
rank,
number.
Not in grade. Yeah. He's ranked in the 20s from a ranking standpoint. He's ranked in the top 10 only twice. And of course, one of them was his MVP caliber season. So I think that's what Cam Newton is. But I also would say he gives the Patriots a better shot than Jarrett Stidham. The issue with New England is even if Brady was coming back and Brady was like 35, you'd still have some question marks like, man, who's going to emerge with the rest of these playmakers? They doubled Julian Edelman last year and nobody else could get open once teams did that. Who's going to replace all this defensive talent, which is a consistent issue. Like that happens all the time in New England, right? There's like all these stars left. Who are the new stars going to be on defense? And they figure it out. But again, Brady's been that, like, it's elite. Brady has been that glue piece. Like, you know, you're getting this baseline from the offense. Under Brady, they average more points than any other team over, you know, since 2006 or whenever we have the data for like 29 points a game during the Brady era that they've averaged. I mean, that's your baseline starting point every single year when you're going through all this other turnover. You can't count on that right now So it is fascinating, the number of question marks in New England right now. So let's start with the offense. Just putting rankings together as far as position groups go. Offensive line was top 10. Not surprising. They're at 7.
Well, that was receivers, before Marcus Cannon.
That was before Marcus Cannon. You're right. That drops. We'll talk about that in a minute. That definitely would drop. Receivers, 29th. It's debatable that they're 30th or 31st or 32nd. Tight ends, 32nd. And honestly, oh no, these aren't my final rankings. These are like the ones.
That will have been before Matt Lacoste opted out, and that wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever.
It would not have made. But the tight ends, like, man, massive question marks, and they invested 2 third-round picks, so who knows. But offensively, you've got a tier three quarterback, and usually if you have a tier three quarterback and you have a nice situation as far as receivers and tight ends go, we talk ourselves into, you know, they'll have a good season. It's a lot harder for Cam Newton to come in here with Julian Edelman and a whole bunch of massive question marks in the receiver and tight end groups.
Yeah, I mean, so across the board, like, question marks is a great way of saying it, right? The everywhere you look with this team, there are now question marks. We just talked about how Belichick is better than anybody else at putting players in a position to succeed, in particular on defense, right? Because that's his area. But he's done it on offense as well. Like, they've rebuilt, they've reshaped and reprofiled that offense many times, depending on the players they've had, including quarterbacks, right? When Brady has gone down, they've had completely different looking offenses. When Jimmy Garoppolo has been quarterback, when Jacoby Brissett has been quarterback, they've done that on offense as well. So question number one is, what the hell does a Cam Newton offense look like in New England? And does Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels' ability to play to the strengths of a player actually bring the best out of Cam Newton in a way they were almost never able to do in Carolina?
I can't wait to see that. I can't wait.
So that is fascinating. Two, because Cam Newton is so, what makes him special is that ability to be a power rushing threat, but it's also the single biggest threat to his own durability and, you know, ability to last the season. What do they do with that? I mean, I've speculated that you might see two offenses, right? Like a conventional one for the first half of the season. And then when the chips are down, we unleash Cam Newton's rushing threat. And suddenly we have something that the league can't defend. That's going to be fascinating to see what they do with that. Or do they just say, hey, we're only paying him for a year and it's hardly costing us anything. Let's just load him up and see what happens.
I was thinking about that too. The 1 year thing, I think, could make them lean like, hey, you can only maximize Cam Newton if you use him as a runner.
Right.
And that was what made him so special in 2015 too.
Can he do it for 19 games?
I don't know. And the way you laid it out kind of made sense too, but like, you can't like go 2-6 the first half of the year and then be like, right, all right, let's unleash him. And on Halloween.
Not. Yeah.
Because you're out of it. But I do think they could try to run him into the ground and just see what happens. I also do believe the reason why they waited so long to sign somebody, like, they do believe in Jarrett Stidham to a point, right? They just would prefer not to start Jarrett Stidham if they had a better option. Like, if they did just run Cam into the ground and then you have Jarrett Stidham and you see what you have in him, like, I don't know that they would hate that an option.
I mean, I don't know how much they believe in Stidham versus how much, like, what were the other options? Now,
Andy,
they might,
I think all the veterans, Andy Dalton, so that's the Nick thing, Foles. Right?
Now, they might believe in him in as far as, look, we're not doing a lot better if Andy Dalton or Nick Foles is starting. But that, I think, is different to, like, he can be the long-term successor. What I think the Cam Newton signing says is that at some point, the deal just became too good to turn down.
So that's where I think they believe in Stidham, right? If they're desperate, they would be desperate at the most important position in the NFL, meaning they would either have traded up for a quarterback.
We don't know. They weren't trying.
They might have, but they were either if they were desperate, they would have signed one of the veterans. They would have done what they could have done to get with the veterans. But because I think they were okay with their baseline of Stidham, they treated the quarterback position like they treat every other position. We'll wait for the second, third, fourth, 12th wave of free agency and Cam Newton's bargain. And in their mind, he's like, oh, we're just kicking the tires on former MVP Cam Newton.
Yeah.
The same way they kicked the tires on former first round pick Tim Tebow.
I mean, look, I think the Cam Newton deal is absolutely not a, hey, look, they just outsmarted everyone, this is genius. It was just like, look, even if they win the Super Bowl and he wins MVP, it costs him like $7.5 million. Like, this was just a deal that was too good to turn down when your current starter is Jarrett Stidham. So, that's all it was. At some point, it just became too big a bargain. You know, when you see something in a bargain bin, it's like 95% off and it costs like $199, marked down from $250. Like, that's what this was, right? At some
point, what's the worst that could happen? You buy it.
At some point, you just go, oh, look, screw it. It's too good. I can't get on board with the idea that they like believe in Stidham beyond like, I just don't think they saw a better option. I don't think they saw a dramatically better option for what would need to have happened for them to pull it off. Right. So the options are you roll with Stidham for a year and we have a better chance at something next year. Like I don't to get to a quarterback at the top of this draft. And by a quarterback, I'm going to assume the Patriots would not have been in love with Justin Herbert. So you're going to need to get above the Dolphins to get to Tua. I mean, that's a lot. I think they basically just went, look, to do that, we're going to have a way better shot at this next year.
I could see we've hypothesized that a team might be willing to do a different quarterback every year and rotate through 1 year contracts and all that stuff. I honestly think that the Colts with the 1 year of Phillip Rivers are in prime position to do that. The Patriots are in prime position to do that. Aaron Rodgers is on record last week basically saying, hey, I'm expecting to not finish my career in Green Bay. The numbers suggest it's going to be really tough to trade for him after this season, but it's not impossible. Is that in the Patriots have a ridiculous amount of 2021 cap space. People have leaned again toward, oh, Belichick's going to tank and get Trevor Lawrence and blah, 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 blah. Belichick's old too. Like he's not coaching for 12 more years of Trevor Lawrence,
so,
right?
Yeah. I mean, that was
is it an Aaron Rodgers thing though? Like, are they going to be a team that just, they either go year to year with the Cam Newtons and Marcus Mariotas, or could they be in the Aaron Rodgers sweepstakes a year from now?
So earlier in this offseason, I did think there was a decent chance the Patriots were actually going to take a shot at this true tanking thing, go for Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields next year. I don't think that's what they're doing anymore. I don't even know if that's ever what they were planning on doing, but I do think there's a good chance they think along the lines of what you just outlined in terms of, look, in this world of relatively replaceable starting quarterbacks, we can hit this baseline of capable starter really easily. And it doesn't have to be Jarrett Stidham. It doesn't have to be Andy Dalton. It's easy. We'll get that guy every year, even if we have to wait until June and sign whoever the Cam Newton is this year. They will do that. They will do what the Vikings did in the 90s and just roll through these veteran quarterbacks and get a capable, solid level of play every single year. And basically, I think, just bide their time until they can stumble into whatever the upgrade is, whether it's somehow things go to hell, a bad season ensues, and they end up with a shot at a Justin Fields or a Trevor Lawrence in any given year, you know, whoever that is in 2021, 2022, 2023. They're basically just going to keep going along until the wheels fall off 1 year, or, you know, somebody makes them an insane trade offer and they wind up with three first round picks that they can parlay into it, or, you know, they trade for an Aaron Rodgers, whatever it is, they're going to keep bumbling along at this baseline of average quarterback play and then look for the freaky upgrade that doesn't come along very often.
I think it's a legitimate theory that could work. I also think this buys them a little bit of time to develop Stidham. If you're going to develop a quarterback, a guy who came out of an Auburn offense who has NFL tools, here's what's in Stidham's favor. Auburn offense, he was a Baylor offense and an Auburn offense that doesn't have a whole lot of translatable NFL stuff. We saw him at the Senior Bowl just look more comfortable and just it felt different. It felt a little bit better at the Senior Bowl. Last year's preseason, the same thing. So we may have already seen, hey, Stidham's starting this development, but you also don't want to like force him out there again with lesser supporting cast in his first year as a starter. So he could actually be something, but you know, but it's also worth, you know, letting him develop. The rest of this offense. Let's start with the playmakers. Julian Edelman, he's getting older.
Yeah. So that was quarterback question mark. Now receiving question marks.
N'Keal Harry, Mohamed Sanu, Jacoby Myers did some nice things last year as an undrafted free agent. They add Demir Byrd. He's your speed guy to kind of replace Philip Dorsett. Just run down the field and take your defense with you.
Not just your speed guy. He's the only. Right. He is the only guy amongst the wide receivers and tight ends that can outrun you.
By the way, listen, I feel really good about Mike Call. Last year, they played Detroit first preseason game, and they crushed them. It was one of those where it's like, we have to over-exaggerate the first preseason game. This team looks great. They dominated. Detroit didn't do a thing. But I was watching the offense, and I'm like, they just look slow. They kept getting open, and they did some good. They were fine, and Stidham had a nice game. They looked so slow. And boy, did that like forecast them being like the slowest team in the NFL. Just nobody. There was just a bunch of 4-6 dudes running around slowly and not getting open during the regular season. They got open against Detroit's second stringers in week one. We're not going to have those fun preseason overreaction takes this year. I'm a little sad with that.
But you're right. There's no speed on this offense still, except Demir Byrd. And I mean, look, Demir Byrd is like, it's not like he's Robbie Anderson. You know, they brought in this like proven track record, deep threat speed guy. Like Demir Byrd has flashed the occasional play here and there, but expecting him to come in and be DeSean Jackson, you know, the one speedster that can answer all your woes feels like a stretch.
So massive question marks around there. And offensive line wise, we ranked them ranked them high because Isaiah Wynn was solid. His first 500 plus snaps as a starter at left tackle. Still want to see a little bit more. Joe Tooney was a top five guard last year at left guard. He is on the franchise tag, making a lot of money this year. Shaq Mason has been one of the league's best over the last few years at right guard. David Andrews is a good center. When I was making the offensive line rankings, we talked about this on the show. If I go and I say solid, 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 question mark, like that's one of the best offensive lines in the NFL.
Right.
That's New England. Four solids and the question, and then Marcus Cannon was actually a question mark at right tackle because he was a couple years removed from his best season. He's now opted out. So right tackle could be Corey Cunningham, could be second-year player Yodney Kajus, who looked like a really nice developmental prospect coming out of West Virginia. Could be Joe Tooney moving from guard or out to tackle, which I don't expect the Patriots to do. But Tooney did play tackle at NC State and was really good at it. And the Patriots probably definitely have better depth on the interior than they do at tackle. So it's a big question mark as far as what they do with Cannon out.
This is also another area where outside things are going to affect what happens here, right? So the offensive line last year looked worse than it had in the past because the receiver sucked.
Yeah.
So the receiver sucked. Brady had to hold the ball longer than he's ever held it before, had to basically wait until pressure arrived, then just get rid of the ball wherever the hell. And because nobody was still open, he was throwing incompletions where he used to throw completions in the face of pressure. So the pressure looks worse. You know what I mean? Independent of the fact that more of it is coming because you're holding onto the ball longer, it also looks like a bigger problem because instead of throwing completions when you're pressured, you're throwing incompletions or interceptions or, you know, whatever. So the offensive line looked like it fell to pieces last year, but actually what was happening is that everything around them was worse. Now you're replacing Tom Brady, who's one of the best in the NFL at getting rid of the ball quickly and minimizing the problems on the offensive line. You're replacing him with Cam Newton, who is at the other end of that scale. Like he will hold on to the ball longer than most. He will hang at the back of a pocket and cause some problems. Generally, he's not an offensive lineman's best friend in terms of making them look good from a pass protection standpoint. The receivers we just talked about do not look like a significant upgrade over the group last year. In fact, they look like the group from last year. There's basically no change. So that's probably not going to make the offensive line look better. Lastly, the best offensive line coach, arguably in NFL history, is no longer working there. Dante Scarnecchia has retired, and the last time that happened, they kind of fell to pieces. So three things that can impact offensive line play are all working against the offensive line.
Yeah, I will be interested to see if Cam, you know, Cam did have that 1 year in Carolina, 2018, that everybody points to. Last time he was healthy, the stats were great. The stats were really good, and he did he was like 2 yards per attempt shorter than he normally is. He was throwing shorter passes and letting Christian McCaffrey run after the catch and all that stuff. And that would be, I'd say, where the Patriots have a strength, is having James White, Rex Burkhead working out of the backfield. Their entire backfield is back intact. Sony Michel. Michel has not been good as a runner, essentially creating above and beyond expectation. They won a Super Bowl with him as the bell cow runner in 2018, but he was not great. He was better in 2018 than he was last year. And you know, he was okay in 2018, but regardless, James White and Rex Burkhead, two guys who can catch the ball out of the backfield. I could see Cam relying on those guys. I could see them trying to run a similar offense from what they had with Brady. I don't know how much more downfield stuff they're actually going to attempt, because again, they don't have the pieces. But in all of the what if scenarios, it's what if N'Keal Harry takes a step forward, or at least becomes uber contested catch space player? What if Mohamed Sanu is healthy coming off of surgery and it gets open a little bit better than he did and understands the offense and is on the same page with Cam? What if Damir Bird adds a little bit of speed and Julian Edelman's the same? Like, if six what ifs happen, the offense is reasonable. And then the tight ends, they were so bad last year with Matt Lacoste and Ryan Izzo. Like, that was the starting group that they brought into the season, and they got what you'd expect out of those two. Two third-round picks, Devin Asiasi, pretty good for a 280-pounder. Jermaine Wiggins-type clone. And Dalton Keene, who can move around the formation and all that. But question at tight end. Question across the offense. The
single most important thing for receivers is separation and speed. And the third-round tight end is pretty good for a 280-pounder.
No, he's got some wiggle at the top of his routes. He's got some wiggle. I like Asiasi. I think he'll be the best.
Getting just quickly to wrap up the offense, a huge amount of – they basically took the same approach with the wide receivers that the 49ers took a year ago with their defensive backs, right? Which is, everyone spent all offseason saying, God, they need to add DBs because they're terrible. And they were like, no, we actually like these guys. They're going to be better next year than they were this year. And the 49ers were right. The Patriots seem to have taken the same approach. They add Damir Bird. Those, you say, that's, you know, it's not like a game changer. So a huge amount of this is this idea that first-round pick N'Keal Harry, with a full season or a full off season and a full year under his belt, is going to be better. And Mohamed Sanu, now that he's working his way back, actually healthy, will be a different player. Do you have confidence in either of those things being true?
No, I try to look, I ranked all the receiving corps, and that was the biggest thing. When I was ranking receiving corps like 24 through 32, I ran through the scenarios of what ifs, and you could see, like, it could happen, but there's no confidence in it. And then even if that happens, you still compare it to the rest of the league. So even if N'Keal Harry becomes like Demaryius Thomas light in year two, and Mohamed Sanu becomes the previous Mohamed Sanu, who's like a pretty good number three, you're still, and then you have Julian Edelman, you're still not looking at the Patriots like, man, there's a top 10 receiving core. Like, even if those good things happen, like, they might rank 20th, they might rank 22nd if that happens. So that's where there are issues. And here's the other thing. Have the Patriots trotted out receiving corps like this before and won? Absolutely. With elite Tom Brady and a Gronk or multiple tight ends or whatever. So that is the difference. There's more pressure on these receivers to produce in this system when there's no tight end production.
Yeah, and they also haven't really done that for like 50 years, and the game's a hell of a lot different now than it was then. You know what I mean?
Well, like, I'm just trying to think of like when else they did. I mean, like 2014, it was Julian Edelman, Brandon LaFell, who had no history of success with Carolina and Cam Newton. And then he became a good player as like the number four option in that offense. But the receiver is not the number four option in this offense anymore.
But the idea of just Julian Edelman versus Julian Edelman and Gronk is a massive difference. Like,
oh, yeah,
that combination is huge. Like, you know, people, I think a lot of people cast their minds way back to the start of Brady, where his receiving core, you know, was like this DeAndre revolving Branch, door David of Patton. Like, yeah, like those guys, right? I don't think you can compare that era NFL to this era NFL. Like, it's the same thing. Like, you know, when we were grading games and you go back to like 06, it's like a different world.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. So you can't just say, well, back in 05, they were running these offenses with no-name receivers, and it was fine. It was perfect. Like, you can't run that system anymore. It doesn't function. Like, this is a passing league in a way it never was back then. It has changed. The other thing I think that's a significant problem in terms of that improvement, for Harry to take that step forward, I think he needs Sanu I think they need both to happen at the same time for one to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in order for, I think you can make N'Keal Harry into a dangerous NFL receiver, but only if you have a guy like Sanu who can play outside and do a lot of the things that I don't think N'Keal Harry can do. If you don't have that, I don't think N'Keal Harry can be successful.
Yeah, because I think he has to be more of a gimmick player in red zone. Like, he's got to be what Brandon LaFell was, the number four option that did some nice things as a number four option. Jacoby Myers could be the wild card, too, because as an undrafted player, he was the one guy who actually showed a little wiggle and worked out of the slot, worked outside, and got open. He was just inconsistent at the catch point, and just in general, there was a reason why he went undrafted, I think. But he could be the wild card as, like, he keeps sneaking in there, maybe stealing some snaps from Sanu and becoming a better option to complement Edelman in year two. So defensively, I don't want to use the phrase question mark again, because
it's
we've used
theme.
It a million times.
Question marks.
But there's questions on defense.
So the first one is, how do they replace Dante Hightower?
Dante Hightower has been the do-it-all. He's a like, he is one of the few guys in the NFL, I always say this, he's a linebacker that you could actually have him rush the passer. Like, you could actually put him on the edge and say, go beat this tackle one-on-one. That doesn't happen. Linebackers don't do that. People thought that happened for years because they were like, oh, he's a 3-4 outside linebacker. He's a linebacker. It's like, it's not the same thing. Hightower had that level of versatility. Van Noy had that level of versatility. They lose both of those guys this offseason. Don't give me that Van Noy face.
I mean, I don't know if Van Noy really had that.
Even just like a Landon Roberts. So that's going to be your buddy, Jawan Bentley, old, you know, hammer, run-stopping backer. It's his time to shine. They bring in Brandon Copeland from the Jets, who has played both. He's like Van Noy. He's played both edge and linebacker in his career. I think it's their chance to just breed the young guys.
Well,
Josh
also,
Uche.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think Uche can come in and do that right off the bat? Because he was a guy, like, his biggest thing in Michigan was, like, this guy doesn't have a position. Like, he's just lining up wherever.
I think he's more pass rusher than
I think he is as well. But he's, like, he's unlike the other guys, he actually has experience of being wherever the hell they wanted him at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued by him. I think he had one of the highest pass rush win rates. He was right up there with Nick Bosa the last couple of years, as far as the best that we've seen.
I think he is a natural, gifted, pure pass rusher, but he actually has some pretty extensive experience of being, you know, a more conventional off-the-ball linebacker in a way that might suddenly become handy when you have to replace a Hightower.
And Jamie Collins, too, by the way, though. But, like, Hightower and Collins, those two guys next to each other as pure backers were just fantastic. They worked off each other really well. They played together in previous years. They got back together last year. Jamie Collins made a ton of plays on the ball. Collins is the athletic guy. Hightower could play the hammer. He could cover backs reasonably enough and all that. That's going to be really tough to replace.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's going to be so interesting to see what they do with it, because one, like, Josh Uche's role is going to be pretty fascinating. Two, I mean, the whole Jawan Bentley thing is fascinating to me generally, and has been since they drafted him, again, because it's the Patriots, right? And you take that guy who is this one-dimensional, thumping, run-stuffing guy that doesn't seem to function in a passing system, and you put him anywhere else in the NFL, and this is why he went in the fifth round. It's like, that doesn't really function. But he goes to the Patriots, and it's like, wow, well, that's a team that actually knows how to use players like that and won't expose them to the things they're not good at. Suddenly, I mean, we've kind of been working on this basis of, you know, he'll actually get, and they seem to like him. So we've been working on this basis of he'll get playing time, he'll look good, and we'll get to see. Now they actually suddenly need him to, you know, Hightower is not there anymore. And suddenly this guy needs to have a pretty significant role right away and be good. And then you've got the usual questions of New England, which is this, like, cycling through guys up front that are just sort of, you know, rotational bodies on the defensive line, and the ever-present question of who the hell is going to generate pressure for them.
The pressure thing is funny because Chase Winovich, 29, they've got, like, a who's who of guys PFF liked from a grading or pass rush win percentage standpoint in college who also didn't go in the first round. Uche is one of them. Chase Winovich, third rounder 2019, got off to a pretty good start as a rookie. Dietrich Wise, you were just sending me, like, dude, just continues to win. Like, he did the same thing at Arkansas. He was a fourth round pick in 2017.
He if you go over the past almost any period of time, he has the best pass rush win rate in the NFL. But over that same period of time, his work rate or his workload for the Patriots has been going down and down and down.
Right. His work against the run has been horrendous.
Abysmal.
He's been destroyed. But if you told me at the end of the year, like, hey, the Patriots stitched together a pass rush of Dietrich Wise, Chase Winovich, and Josh Uche is the main catalyst, or maybe Byron Cowart, the fifth round pick in 2019, former five-star, I wouldn't be surprised. So I'm less worried about that because they've won with lesser pass rushes. Shalik Calhoun is up there. John Simon. I mean, it is a whole bunch of either unheralded college types that deserve a shot or reclamation projects up front. Lawrence Guy, Bo Allen, they'll stitch it together up front. And you know, I think Danny Shelton was actually a solid run defender that they might miss a little bit. They don't have that type of huge body there, but I think they'll be okay up front. Linebacker, question mark. Secondary is where they're good. This is their strength. This is the reason why New England's in every game now. Is Stephon Gilmore the best cover corner in the NFL, the best man coverage corner in the man coverage scheme? Jason McCourty and J.C. Jackson, that's your best trio, one of your best trios in the NFL. Probably your best trio of just straight outside corners, though. I mean, those guys, they are legit. Jonathan Jones, a really good slot corner. Devin McCourty's still there at safety. You lose Daron Harmon and his dependability on the back end, always making plays. Terrence Brooks, not as good there. Add Kyle Duggar, the second round. Patrick Chungy type of replacement now that, and you see that sooner than later now. Now that Chung is out, but they're deep and they've got some really good players all throughout the secondary.
Yeah. I'm kind of with you. I think the front seven we assume will be fine because of the Patriots, right?
Like, yes.
I think people generally default to that as an idea. Oh, they'll be okay because it's the Patriots and this is what they do. I think if there's any area where that is legitimately like a thing, it's the front seven. They've consistently been able to just throw bodies at that and figure out where they fit. And even if it's not the ones you expected, they emerge. Somebody emerges, right? It might not be the guy that you thought it was going to be, but someone's going to show up, spend 500 snaps being pretty good at what he does well, and you're okay. So I think we assume the front will be okay. The back end is where it gets interesting because they're really good there and should be able to patch up a lot. The one thing that's also interesting is like, that's a lot of leadership that's departed and not just departed, but is opting out as well. The Hightower and Chung thing, like those are two of the most important voices on that team. Suddenly that's a lot resting on Devin McCourty and Stephon Gilmore, who's not really a vocal, you know, presence, really good presence, you know, arguably the best cornerback in the NFL, but not that type of lead, more of a leader by example guy than a leader by, you know, any kind of inspiration.
It's a really good point, because say what you want about PFF and how we don't quantify that stuff, so sometimes we don't focus on it, but in New England's history, they had their first run last two decades ago now. That had the Teddy Bruschis of the world, and they had Ty Law. They had that like nucleus of dudes who just came through the system and everything. But let's not forget, like this defense hit a lull. Like there was a point between like 09 and 12, there was a point where this defense was not good. And name talent on the team wasn't that bad, but they were kind of lacking. You know, Bruschi had retired, and Law was like, a lot of those guys were gone. Willie McGinnis, all those guys were well gone. They didn't have a nucleus of leaders. Belichick relies on those guys. And then they started to become good again once McCourty became like, he's a veteran now, and he's one of the leaders of the new wave, and Hightower and Chandler Jones or whoever else it was at the time. That is a question mark. It is a question because it's different, and we haven't, you know, they haven't had to deal with this to this extent in many years. So I still think the defense will be good. Let's also not forget, they looked like the 85 Bears defensively when they were going up against like Luke Falk and a whole bunch of questionable quarterbacks, terrible quarterbacks the first half of the year. And then the second half of the year, Lamar Jackson, Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, it didn't come crashing down defensively. It just came back down to earth, like where they should have been. So like any other defense, they're at the mercy of who they face.
Yeah. And for the third of four times this podcast, their schedule gets harder this year. So it's going to look tougher.
All right. Let's wrap up New England, man. Are they right there with the Bills still competing for the division? Is Bill Belichick the only thing that's keeping you saying they're in the mix? Like if any other head coach is there,
yes,
you're calling them a 5-win team.
Yeah, 6. But yes, I don't think that's unreasonable. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that man for man, this is not a particularly good roster right now. If it wasn't for Bill Belichick, you would not expect this team, particularly against a team like the Bills in the division, you would not be expecting them to win it. I think that almost because the schedule is getting harder, his ability and style of going game by game, game plan by game plan, you know, not system for the year, like his ability to take each single game plan and come up with the best way of beating the opposition is going to sneak them a couple of wins versus what the Bills or the Jets or the Dolphins will do in the same tough circumstances of a stronger schedule. So I think the Patriots will sneak a couple of wins that they shouldn't get, and they'll probably end up, in the same like 9-10 win range that the Bills will be.
Here's the one thing I want to warn people that are going to use the Matt Cassel. I've said this before, but the Matt Cassel, Jimmy Garoppolo, Jacoby Brissett idea. Oh, they won without those guys. Those teams that those guys played with.
Right.
Brady was 32-2.
The Cassel one is the worst, right? It's like, oh, they won 11 games in Matt Cassel. It's like, yeah, but they won 16 the game.
They were 16-0, 18-1. And then they, went 11-5.
Yeah.
With the easiest schedule, one of the easiest schedules. And then in 2016, that team, once Brady came back from a suspension, they went 14-1.
Yeah.
And they lost their only game like at the buzzer and they won the Super Bowl. And that was the game, that was the team that Garoppolo and Brissett went 3-1 with. Like, okay, great. Like the two times that Brady didn't play were probably the two best rosters in Patriots history. So that would be like the, oh, he's done it before. Well, Cam Newton's about to take over a not so good Patriots roster relative to the last 20 years of this dynasty. So,
but I mean, it is a very real thing that look, Belichick is the greatest coach in NFL history.
Oh yeah.
And I think the greatest coach in terms of doing those things we talked about, tailoring what you have doing the best that you can with what you have. And at no point is that more important than when everything changes, so this is the year that actually makes the biggest difference it's ever made, because everything is different. Everything's just gone to hell. Question marks everywhere. And the best way of addressing those question marks is actually having a guy that will work towards what they do, what their strengths are.
So I think the Patriots, I think I would pick the Bills to win the AFC East. I think the Pats, 8-win team.
8. Okay. I'm going to go with 9.
8-8. New York Jets. Let's wrap it up, Sam.
Yes.
Speaking of question marks, let's call this, the Patriots were the question mark team. This is the what if team, because the what ifs are all over the offensive line and the in receiver. Let's go through the team rankings here. And I never really finalized these. Remember, I just put like 32 next to all the teams I think were terrible.
You know what the most surprising thing about the Jets is, just from the get-go, they won 7 games last year.
Sneaky 7.
Right. Sam Darnold got mono and they still won 7 games.
Luke Falk and Trevor Siemian played football for them last year and they still won 7 games.
Exactly.
I think
this is another example though of like 7 games, we get a little bit better, we win 8 or 9. No, because the schedule gets harder, you're going to win 7 or less again and it's going to feel like a disappointment.
Here's my biggest concern. We rank their secondary, their Jamal Adams-less secondary, 32nd. And whatever. When we rank a team 32nd, like they could be 29th, they could be, doesn't matter. They're not projected to be good.
All right, let's start there though, because we haven't done the Jamal Adams thing.
I love the move for the Jets.
Yes.
Love the move for the Jets.
So Bradley McDougald is not a terrible replacement for Jamal Adams.
He's one of my guys for the My Guy podcast. I'm a big McDougald fan.
Look, you can make the case that Jamal Adams is the best do-it-all safety in the NFL, right? He's a top, 25 player in the entire league, but he plays a not particularly important position. And Bradley McDougald, I don't want to say he's a poor man's version because he's not bad. Like, he's a decent player. But whatever the next rung up from poor man's is, a lower middle class version of Jamal Adams, right? He's a pretty good replacement. To get a first round pick and Bradley McDougald would have been a great trade for the Jets. To get another first on top of that is absurd.
I think it's huge. And Jamal Adams is the best do-it-all safety. Bradley McDougald, you could make the case, is the best Kansas safety in the NFL. And Kansas safeties, Sam, they don't do anything in life. They're terrible at everything. Huh. Costco. So McDougald just becoming a pretty good NFL player. Good for him. No, seriously, though, the Jets, here's the overarching point, right? 2018, they trade up to get Sam Darnold. They had five other picks, not one, and they were all third rounder later. The following year, they had six total picks, only a first rounder, no second rounder. When you trade up to go get a quarterback, you almost certainly have to draft in volume, and you have to replenish those picks somewhere, or else you're playing whack-a-mole with your roster. You're trying to shore up the offensive line. Oh no, now we have to shore up the receiver. Oh no, the secondary is falling apart. This is the consistent theme right now. If you trade up for a quarterback, you have to make up for it somewhere. So,
or the quarterback that you trade up for has to be able to paper over those cracks, right?
Oh, like, so that'd be like if Mahomes.
If the quarterback, yeah. Well, not even Mahomes. So Mahomes is the obvious example, right? But Deshaun Watson is another. Like, yes. Deshaun Watson has been good enough where you can shortchange him with the rest of the roster, and he's good enough to overcome that. Darnold is not yet. Jared Goff is not. Like,
and it's perfect example, Sam. That's great. Because I think Houston's playing whack-a-mole too. Their secondary is terrible, but they spent a whole year on their offensive line while everything else got depleted. And that's what's keeping them from being a fringe play, like a we get into the playoffs team to the team that's challenging Mahomes and the Chiefs, because they could be there. The Jets are playing whack-a-mole with just a roster to, be competitive. And my concern is where they're weak, secondary and receiver. So now that if you can separate the fact that Jamal Adams is awesome, and the initial reaction for people is like, you draft every year to find a player like Jamal Adams. But if you could take a deeper look at this and say you got 3 years of Jamal Adams play, granted, yeah, they didn't win anything, but it doesn't matter. Like, you got 3 years of service time out of Jamal Adams, your first round pick, and then flipped him for two other first round picks. And as you mentioned, a solid player, like, you make that deal every single time. And it's only because superstars by name in the NFL that are not quarterbacks, they're just not as important. They just don't win games like superstars in other sports. Jamal Adams is a star in the NBA. If you traded for a star of Jamal Adams or traded of Jamal Adams caliber, you go from bad team to playoff team to, like, that makes you like a title contender. If you in the NHL, it probably impacts less.
Right.
In baseball, it probably impacts pretty strongly, like star players have. But in the NFL, star non-quarterbacks do not move the needle at the same level as other sports. And I think it's really tough for fans to understand that disconnect.
Also, you don't have to pay them.
And the money thing.
Right.
Right.
So, like, if you'd got nothing else out of this other than Bradley McDougald and a first round pick, it would have been a good move. The fact that you get another first round pick and you don't have to pay his contract, I get that you've said goodbye to your best player and that sucks, but it's such the right move for the Jets, and it's a great deal for them. But I mean, it doesn't, the problem is it doesn't help right now, right?
It does not. It does not help right now.
But that, so, I mean, that's the problem when you're talking about, it's season preview time and you just got worse. Great.
Here's why we think they're the 32nd best secondary. That might be harsh. I'm not I honestly, when I was putting the secondaries together, I said there's seven teams that could be last. So they could be 25th. This could be the 25th best secondary. It depends on where you want to rank them. That's just who I am. I should have tiered everything. I tiered my quarterbacks. I should have tiered the secondaries. Pierre Desir at cornerback could be good, has been okay at best throughout his career. Arthur Millett is going to start, or Quincy Wilson's going to start at the other cornerback position, or Nate Hairston. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen there. Brian Poole has one good year under his belt. He's coming over to play nickel, or he's going to play nickel. Sorry. And then Marcus May has been a solid safety. He's been a nice little free safety to complement Jamal Adams flying around all over the field. And Bradley McDougald is a solid, strong safety, as we said. There's some solid in there. There might not be last, but they're in the bottom third of the league. Ashton Davis, if he's healthy, nice little third-round pick. They've got some good safeties. Cornerback is a massive question mark, though.
Yes, I think that sums it up. Their safety situation is not bad. Their cornerback situation very probably is. They've got.
And it's not
some...
like they have the pass rush to protect them for the 15th
yes.
year. Their pass rush is poor.
It's nobody. I don't. How is this team like the last good pass rusher the Jets had was John Abraham, who a lot of people are too young to remember him being a good pass rusher. Like, yeah. That's how long ago this was. That's nuts. That should Other not be possible.
On the edge, at least. Yeah, we had Mohamed Wilkerson. Yeah.
I mean, as an edge rusher. Edge.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're trotting Jordan Jenkins, Terrell Basham, Harvey Lange. I mean, those are the guys they're trotting out there. They could have been 32nd and defensive line, except Seattle, I think, might even be worse.
Yeah.
Jafari Zuniga could be, third-round pick. Move him around. Our boy Henry Anderson on the interior. But they need a lot to happen up front to help protect what's happening on the back end.
Yeah. Nobody on their edge rushing group last year topped 40 total pressures, which when you consider their top two rush the passer 668 times is wretched return in terms of pressure rate. That's awful. It's amazing how hard they've been struggling to find those guys. A huge amount for this team, the defense, rests in Quinnen Williams becoming the Quinnen Williams that we thought he was going to be, as opposed to the guy we saw last year.
Yeah.
Like that to me was one of the most surprising first year performances of any rookie we've seen come out since we've been grading college. Like in terms of the guy being completely different to what you thought he would be. That is one of the biggest shocks to me. Not just that, like, he didn't play as good as we thought he would be, but that he was completely anonymous as a pass rusher and any good he did was as a run defender. Like, I thought at the minimum we would see a guy that was a pretty good pressure player right out of the gate and then we'd see how good he could be in terms of rounding out his play. But he was nothing as a pass rusher.
Yeah, sometimes I worry about he had one full year as a starter and he had like 200 snaps of awesome previous mm-hmm. to that. So we talked him up. We thought he was great. Sometimes in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, do we put too much stock in just that one year? And sometimes do college players in NFL, do players progress the same way they did in college in the NFL? So he didn't play early on at Alabama. He slowly eased his way into the lineup. And like by his third year, it's like, okay, here's a star. Sometimes will you see some of that at the NFL level as well? Sometimes I think guys might just progress in a similar manner. Start slow and build it up. And then, okay, then by year two or year three or whatever it is, they look better. I think that's what the Jets need to bank on here. Can I ask you something?
Yes.
Adam Gase.
Yes.
He is universally acknowledged in our circles as a poor head coach. Okay. LOL, Adam Gase, you're an idiot. You run an archaic offense that doesn't help your quarterback. You do all this stuff. I think Jim Caldwell had a little bit of that, right? Like Jim Caldwell, nobody was like, here's this dynamic, awesome head coach. But Caldwell had his teams overachieve a little bit. Is it fair to suggest that Adam Gase's teams have actually overachieved? They've at least reached their baseline, if not overachieved, in 4 years as head coach. Let me remind you of what's happened. In 2016, the Miami Dolphins went 10-6 and made it to the playoffs. In 2017, Ryan Tannehill missed the whole season. They pulled Jay Cutler off of a Fox broadcast and future reality TV career to win six. Jay Cutler, right off the couch, smoking butts, not working out, 6 wins. 2018 Dolphins, right before they started the re, like, they might have been a little bit better roster than they were 7-9 though. 2018, he gets fired out. 7-9 Dolphins, probably where they should have been. And last year's horrendous Jets were 7-9, as you mentioned, mono and whatever. Adam Gase in our circles is generally frowned upon, looked down upon, and whatever. I'm not saying that's wrong. But is it also crazy to suggest, given the rosters he's been given, he's at least reached his baseline, and if not, overachieved, based off what I just read?
I think the bottom number, like wins and losses, which certainly for some people, that's all they're going to care about. I think you're going to make the case that he's done as well as you could expect him to do. The problem is that this is a guy who made his name out of being a quarterback guru. You know, he was there, Denver, right? That's where Peyton Manning revival with Denver,
yep.
Which, and so it's always a little bit concerning when one guy is given a significant amount of credit for something that appears to be very much somebody else's thing, yeah. Right? Like Peyton Manning was massively successful in Denver almost 100% because they junked whatever plan they were going to run with and just said, tell us what to run. Like Manning comes in, we're going to have this hybrid offense of what you used to do and what we do now, and it's going to be amazing. And 3 games in, it was like, Manning can't throw. All right, Peyton, tell us what the hell to run. You know your body better than we do. Help us out here. Manning like reinvented his own offense, became an MVP again, and it's one of the most absurd things ever. And Adam Gase comes out of that with a lot of credit. That, to me, is a little bit concerning. Now, he goes to Miami, and you have this guy in Ryan Tannehill who had a pretty high baseline. Now, maybe you can argue that, you know, given he was a pretty high first-round pick, he never developed into the player you thought he was going to be, given how quickly he started and how sort of young he was from an experience point of view at quarterback, given, you know, college wide receiver to quarterback, blah, blah, blah. But the point is, he didn't get better under Gase's tutelage. Neither has Sam Darnold yet, but obviously he's got the caveats of mono and all those kinds of things. But basically, like, where's the evidence that the thing he's supposed to be good at has been getting better under his watch? Like, if anything, the evidence says the thing that he's supposed to be good at is headed in the wrong direction under his watch. I mean, look, this year, I think, is a big year for Gase and for Darnold, right? They're both sort of entering these must-perform seasons. Darnold, it's fine. Like last year, you had the caveat of mono. But basically, there's almost no evidence at this point of Sam Darnold being anything other than not very good.
Let me make the case really quick.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a believer. I'm just looking at some of the evidence. In the first year that he was in Miami, Ryan Tannehill, just using passer rating as a proxy, had the highest passer rating of his career, and his grade hadn't changed, right?
Yeah.
In 2018, Tannehill was horrendous. Remember, he was fumbling left and right, turnover-worthy plays like crazy, and somehow just he had a 92.7 passer rating as well. Like, he had really good numbers that year because of yards after the catch and screens and all that stuff. So he hasn't developed quarterbacks necessarily.
Right.
But his offenses have gotten production that's above expectation.
Yeah, but
than previously.
Two things with that. One, it's concerning to me that the quarterback has not improved under his watch. Right?
I get it.
The fact that the quarterback has, if anything, gotten worse, not better, is more important than the fact that the passer rating and as a proxy of the overall passing offense has gotten better. The other thing is, when you use the R&D guys, Eric Eager and the data science, when they look into the sort of coaching above expectation stuff, he doesn't show well in that. So I don't think it's necessarily correct to credit him for the fact that Tannehill's passer rating was higher than his grade says it should have been.
Bringing it up as a point.
I think you can, it makes sense logically, but the data in terms of what you expect over expectation is not there. So something else is driving that.
I'm not looking at the greatest groups of supporting cast that they've had or anything like that either.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
So look, He doesn't. He's probably a far better coach than crazy eyes press conference guy would suggest, right? I think that's a legitimate thing that's working against him. As everyone took a look at that press conference and went, "That's absurd. Like, there's no way this guy is a top end head coach." And genuinely, he probably has to battle that. He's not like a walking disaster. The guy's not garbage. I'm just saying that he's now entering a season where the quarterback needs to perform, and therefore, like, this is the year he needs to perform as well, because this is a quarterback guru staring at a season where his team has a quarterback who's in a make or break year. If they both stink, it's problems for everybody.
Let's just wrap up the defense really quick. CJ Mosley is the big name that opted out. He only played a handful of snaps last year, signed that big contract. He's a better run defender than he is coverage player in general at linebacker. So, like, signing him for that big money was a massive question mark. Hey, drink, question mark at the time anyway. But they just lost their two best defensive players potentially. So I think the defense is going to be in trouble this season. The question is going to be offensively. Whether Sam Darnold, again, does not have a great group of playmakers as far as we know what we're going to get from these guys. They might have the widest range of outcomes of any wide receiver core in the NFL. And maybe the offensive line, I don't know if the offensive line has the widest range of outcomes, but it has a wide range. So this is make or break year for Sam Darnold. And we've made the point before, he could get better and it might not show statistically. And I'm okay with that. I just want to see him take a step forward. And I think the team is still in the middle of a rebuild, especially offensively. Ton of resources thrown at the offensive line. They're probably another year of resources being thrown at it to get it back to average and on track. Just released Brian Winters, who was one of the guys that we thought like would at least compete for starting. Like, he's been the starter there. It's also funny when, like, he hasn't been a good starter in a few years.
Did you see the tweet?
Yeah, I saw the tweet.
Starting guard won't be on, you know, starting caliber guard won't be on, right. You know, won't be available for long. It's like, yeah, but that's like, how good was he when he was starting? Like, just starting is not.
That's like us saying, like, we release Sam and it's like podcast host free at the Ringer.
Yeah, it's like full timer won't be available for long.
So anyway, I think that locks in Greg Van Roten as the starting right guard. Potentially coming off his career year, Connor McGovern, the career year at center, Alex
Winters,
Lewis,
highest career grade in a season,
71,
70.5.
Yeah, so 70.
He has right. 1, 2, 3 seasons in the 60s, one with 70.5 and one with a 56.
And that was like 3 years ago, 4 years ago in the 70s.
Yeah, three more in the 50s. In fact. So again, like, this is your baseline is below average.
Right. So I think Van Roten's at guard, McGovern at center, right tackle's a battle between George Fant and Chuma Edoga, which is our, like, that doesn't feel great. And then Mekhi Becton, he's a rookie left tackle that mm-hmm. we had some concerns about. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that line. But we right now rank him in like the bottom five.
I mean, yes. Some guy did the math on it, right? Let's assume all of them are coin flips to be average. If that's the case, this offensive line has a 1 in 32 chance of being an average unit. Like, the chance of flipping heads five times in a row. It's extremely unlikely. Now, some of them may be better than that, right? Like Connor McGovern in particular, given that he's coming off his best year, it may be a better than 50% chance of being average. But like, that's the kind of thing you're dealing with here, right? You're trying to overhaul an entire group and expect all five of them to get better. It's not likely.
That offsets the fact that the right tackle position is not even close to a coin flip with George Fant, who's graded in the 40s when playing tackle, and Edoga, who's a third round pick, who graded in the 40s while playing tackle in his only year. So, yes. But I could see the receiving core come together. Breshad Perriman averaged over 17 yards per catch last year. Started to look like that first round talent. Hasn't dropped passes like he was earlier in his career. Denzel Mims, the other vertical threat that you liked coming out of the draft. Jamison Crowder, he's very much like Cole Beasley in the slot. You know he's going to get open. He does it well when he's healthy. He at least gives you that security blanket. And then who knows if Josh Doctson could become a pretty decent number four. And Chris Herndon comes back at tight end. It's not good compared to the rest of the league on paper, but there's enough what ifs that if the, you know, if those hit, you're like, hey, Sam Darnold's got his best supporting cast here at least.
Yeah, I do kind of like this group. Obviously, I like Denzel Mims more than a lot of people. But this, he was, I think, one of the more polarizing receiving prospects this year. Like, people seem to either be major Denzel Mims stands or like thinking he was, you know, thinking he was a low second round pick.
Right.
I like him a lot. I think he's got the ability to do a lot of things for them. Breshad Perriman, I think, is the big sort of gamble. He's the most important thing from this receiving core, right? Because he showed the back end of last year that he was capable of being like a high end starting difference making receiver, which is what he should be given where he was drafted, right? Which is, was he top 10? Like, he was a highly
talented, not that high. Not
pretty
that
high though, right? He was
20. He was in the 20s, I think.
20s? Okay.
Yeah.
So he was a first round highly touted receiver with devastating speed and big time size, but it had been a disaster in two previous spots, Cleveland, Baltimore, winds up in Tampa, buried on their depth chart, and then injuries hit and suddenly he's like a starter for the last few games of the season, has three back-to-back-to-back 100-yard games, makes some spectacular catches, looks like the guy he was supposed to be. And like, that ability is still there, but it was like, we're not even talking small samples. Like, we were concerned about the small sample size of Quinnen Williams based off a year plus 200 snaps. Like, Perriman has had the 200 snaps and bad play before that. So it's a huge question mark about whether he can even replicate what Robbie Anderson left, which is, you know, one of the more consistent deep threats in the NFL. That is a big gamble, but I think the payoff is huge. So I can definitely see a world where Perriman realizes his potential. Mims is the player I thought he was coming out. And Jamison Crowder is a really good go-to guy from the slot. You're right. That suddenly becomes a really interesting group, particularly with Le'Veon Bell out of the backfield. 125-year-old Frank Gore pounding the ball at the middle. Like, there was the...
I was wondering which piece you were laughing at, whether it was Bell catching passes or if you'd gotten to read Gore's name on the
deck. No, just the idea that Frank Gore is still playing football in today's NFL is hilarious to me. But that's not a terrible group of, you know, supporting cast skill position players.
I agree. It's just, they're the what-if team, right? Because we just said, if this, if that. It's a lot of if-then statements for our coders out there, for our programmers.
This season... with his opt-out, I think, assuming I've done the math right, C.J. Mosley is going to have earned $254,000 for every snap he's played in his first two seasons for the Jets.
Oh, that's Chase Daniel style.
That's way better than Chase Daniel.
Did you finally correct your numbers on that? He was over 200K per attempt or something, wasn't he?
Yeah, I had it all. I had a decimal in the wrong place. I was off by a factor of 10.
I wrote about Le'Veon in the running back section. Nothing sums up the running back's dependency on their run blocking than Bell averaging only 3.2 yards per carry last year.
Yeah.
And he had a 69.9 rushing grade. The previous year, his rushing grade was actually worse, 67.7. He averaged 4 yards per carry. So 0.8 difference, very similar rushing grade. Some of it was fumble driven with the Steelers, but either way, the Jets had the third lowest run blocking grade in the league last year. So Mekhi Becton, I think, improves that at least. Like, he'll give him an opportunity and, like, you know, some of those runs off the left side and all that backside cutoffs or whatever he does. But this will be an interesting one. I could see a path where the playmakers look good. Yeah. I could definitely see that. But you got to figure out what you have in Sam Darnold. And again, the reason why the Jamal Adams trade is important, it gives you flexibility for the first round. Now in the future, two first rounders coming up. Are you going to be looking for the next quarterback, or are you just looking to build around Sam Darnold? I think regardless of what you're looking to do, you need that kind of flexibility as a roster. Don't forget, Joe Flacco's there.
This team, I think, it's all down to what happens with Sam Darnold, right? Every season we've seen him, dating back to college, there's been a stretch you can put together where it's like, Sam Darnold looks amazing. Right? College, you know, if you make the right split, he's the worst quarterback in the country versus the best, right? Or close to it. In year one, it's like, that was pretty ugly, but look at the last couple of games, right? The last few games, put it all together. It was one of the best. It was Mr. December. It looked like the best quarterback in the NFL for December.
The Geno Smith.
Right. Then last season it was, he's got mono, so you have to throw out the first half of the year. And then again, look at this stretch down the back. That's where it was. That was a real Sam Darnold. Like every year there's a stretch where Sam Darnold fans will make the case that he's the best guy. And then you've got this group of guys that are just like madly obsessed with him. Like Dan Orlovsky says he would take him as the best young quarterback in the NFL right now. Over MVP Lamar Jackson.
Dan's never come off his Darnold take. And I loved a lot of what Darnold did coming out of college.
Yes. But my point is like the people that are Darnold stans are like, they're out there. Like they are. And there's something every year to keep those guys in there. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. I mean, Daniel Jeremiah loves him and Dan Orlovsky loves him.
Equally,
and
every year there's like some pretty significant caveats to those impressive plays.
Look, I still believe Darnold can be pretty good. I don't like just throwing the age thing out there. He's still young though.
Yes.
So only 23 years old right now. So I could see him, developing. I also think it's fair to say he's had maybe the worst situation. Remember, all of those quarterbacks came in. Darnold had a bad situation. Rosen had one of the worst situations we've seen in recent years. And Josh Allen had a bad situation. In that time, Josh Allen now has a great one.
Yeah.
Josh Rosen, that doesn't have any more opportunities.
Yes.
And Darnold now still has a bad situation. Still has potentially. We'll see what happens if they develop. But yeah, definitely a pivotal year for Sam. You want to see him at least make progress, even if everything around him isn't great. From a Jets standpoint, it's almost like they're starting the rebuild again. Joe Douglas is only in his first full year as a GM, so there's still more work to do with this.
Yeah, roster. I mean, obviously Darnold is the big differentiator. How good he is going to be what determines how good this team is. But the other big thing is the offensive line is a 1 in 32 chance that it becomes average, but where does it fall on that spectrum? Right.
Yeah.
Cause ultimately, I mean, there's a 1 in 32 chance it becomes average. There's a smaller chance that it becomes really good. Like all five of those things hit and they all have career years again. They suddenly have a better than average offensive line. But again, it's the what ifs. Like the range of outcomes for pretty much everything on the Jets is insane. Like it's the broadest spectrum of any team in the NFL, maybe. And that offensive line could go anywhere from like a pretty good unit to a disaster again.
Here's the interesting thing, right? I only pose the Adam Gase question because like if you just hear how bad a guy is over and over again, like you just... It's probably not as bad as what you're saying. And I use Jim Caldwell as an example. Everybody wanted to push Jim Caldwell out of Detroit. When you actually look back, it's like he made the playoffs with some mediocre rosters. Like he actually made. He's not a top 10 coach or anything, but he probably overachieved. I'm not saying Adam Gase is that guy, but it is interesting. I don't think he's had the best situations. And then I'll say, if you want the offensive line to hit and the playmakers to hit and all that stuff, Adam Gase might not be the guy. They might not have the people in place to do that. Now, if you brought in like Sean McVay out of nowhere, if you had a McVay type where he just rejuvenated the Rams in 2017 with this group of playmakers, like you could see that too. And that would be the argument against Gase. Like, do you think Gase is going to get the most out of these guys? Or if you had, what's his face from Oklahoma?
Lincoln Riley.
Lincoln Riley. I'm like Riley. It's late, Sam.
It is.
Like if Lincoln Riley came in and got the most out of these guys, would you be surprised?
It's one.
Welcome back, podcast. It's I don't know
what
morning. We're doing.
How in God's name do we spin out four teams into 2.5 hours?
This was a big mistake.
The next division should probably be shorter than this.
We're wrapping it up. That's it. Welcome to season 9, PFF NFL podcast. We're going to do 2.5 hours every single week.
We've decided that Joe Rogan is the most successful podcaster in the world. So we're just going to do 5-hour podcasts every week.
Oh gosh. They just take pee breaks in the middle of it and stuff too, right?
Should we do that now? Come back for part two.
Yeah. Let's knock out the AFC North.
No, just the whole AFC. We could just roll through the morning.
We should. Right into our 9 a.m. meeting.
Right. The morning meeting is at 9 a.m. That gives us That gives us 8 clear hours to get through the next 3 divisions.
Don't tempt me here. Let's do it. I just wrote 60,000 words on all the teams. They're fresh. I'm ready.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, that'll do it for the AFC East podcast, though. In reality, that's it. So
go take a pee, get a coffee, and we'll just roll through the next 8 hours, and we'll have like a podcast. We'll have a Joe Rogan beating podcast.
Based off the text messages I'm getting, I got to go clean the kitchen, and that's not happening tonight. So
excellent.
Good to have you back, Sam.
Thanks.
If you guys missed us last week, just listen to this in 3 different parts. It'll be like we never left.
Yeah. This podcast, by the way, is so large that the audio file is now measured in gigabytes, not megabytes.
Oh, no.
An audio
file.
We're not
even going to be able to send it. We're not even going to be able to send it properly.
I don't know. That's somebody else's problem.
That's it. We're out. We'll be back on Thursday with another division for probably less than 2.5 hours.
God, yes.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
We can't run at this kind of time on somebody else's dime. This has got to be free time in the middle of the night.
It's only after the kids go to sleep.
Yeah. Right. Bye-bye.
See ya.